This is Audible.
Problem at Polenta Bay and Other Stories by Agatha Christie. Read by Hugh Fraser. Problem at Polenta Bay. The steamer from Barcelona to Mallorca landed Mr. Parkerpine at Palma in the early hours of the morning, and straight away he met with disillusionment. The hotels were full. The best that could be done for him was an airless cupboard overlooking an inner court in a hotel in the centre of town, and with that Mr. Parkerpine was not prepared to put up. The proprietor of the hotel was indifferent to his disappointment. "What will you?" he observed with a shrug. Palma was popular now. The exchange was favourable. Everyone, the English, the Americans, they all came to Mallorca in the winter. The whole place was crowded. It was doubtful if the English gentleman would be able to get in anywhere, except perhaps at Formentor, where the prices were so ruinous that even foreigners blenched at them. Mr. Parkerpine partook of some coffee and a roll, and went out to view the cathedral, but found himself in no mood for appreciating the beauties of architecture. He next had a conference with a friendly taxi driver, in inadequate French, interlarded with native Spanish, and they discussed the merits and possibilities of Solaire, Alcudia, Polenta, and Formentor, where there were fine hotels, but very expensive. Mr. Parkerpine was goaded to inquire how expensive. "They asked," said the taxi driver, "an amount that it would be absurd and ridiculous to pay. Was it not well known that the English came here because prices were cheap and reasonable?" Mr. Parkerpine said that that was quite so, but all the same, what sums did they charge at Formentor? "A price incredible." "Perfectly. But what price, exactly?" The driver consented at last to reply in terms of figures. Fresh from the exactions of hotels in Jerusalem and Egypt, the figure did not stagger Mr. Parkerpine unduly. A bargain was struck. Mr. Parkerpine's suitcases were loaded on the taxi in a somewhat haphazard manner, and they started off to drive round the island, trying cheaper hostelries en route, but with the final objective of Formentor. But they never reached that final abode of plutocracy. For after they had passed through the narrow streets of Polenta and were following the curved line of the seashore, they came to the Hotel Pino d'Oro, a small hotel standing on the edge of the sea, looking out over a view that in a misty haze of a fine morning had the exquisite vagueness of a Japanese print. At once Mr. Parkerpine knew that this, and only this, was what he was looking for. He stopped the taxi, passed through the painted gate with the hope that he would find a resting place. The elderly couple to whom the hotel belonged knew no English or French. Nevertheless, the matter was concluded satisfactorily. Mr. Parkerpine was allotted a room overlooking the sea. The suitcases were unloaded. The driver congratulated his passenger upon avoiding the monstrous exigencies of these new hotels, received his fare, and departed with a cheerful Spanish salutation. Mr. Parkerpine glanced at his watch, and perceiving that it was even now but 9:45, he went out onto the small terrace now bathed in a dazzling morning light and ordered, for the second time that morning, coffee and rolls. There were 4 tables there, his own, one from which breakfast was being cleared away, and 2 occupied ones. At the one nearest him sat a family of father and mother and 2 daughters, Germans. Beyond them, at the corner of the terrace, sat what were clearly an English mother and son. The woman was about 55. She had grey hair of a pretty tone, was sensibly but not fashionably dressed in a tweed coat and skirt, and had that comfortable self-possession which marks an Englishwoman used to much travelling abroad. The young man who sat opposite her might have been 25, and he too was typical of his class and age. He was neither good-looking nor plain, tall nor short. He was clearly on the best of terms with his mother. They made little jokes together, and he was assiduous in passing her things. As they talked, her eye met that of Mr. Parkerpine. It passed over him with well-bred nonchalance, but he knew that he had been assimilated and labelled. He had been recognised as English, and doubtless in due course some pleasant non-committal remark would be addressed to him. Mr. Parkerpine had no particular objection. His own countrymen and women abroad were inclined to bore him slightly, but he was quite willing to pass the time of day in an amiable manner. In a small hotel it caused constraint if one did not do so. This particular woman, he felt sure, had excellent hotel manners, as he put it. The English boy rose from his seat, made some laughing remark, and passed into the hotel. The woman took her letters and bag and settled herself in a chair facing the sea. She unfolded a copy of the Continental Daily Mail. Her back was to Mr. Parkerpine. As he drank the last drop of his coffee, Mr. Parkerpine glanced in her direction, and instantly he stiffened. He was alarmed, alarmed for the peaceful continuance of his holiday. That back was horribly expressive. In his time he had classified many such backs, its rigidity, the tenseness of its poise. Without seeing her face, he knew well enough that the eyes were bright with unshed tears, that the woman was keeping herself in hand by a rigid effort. Moving warily, like a much-hunted animal, Mr. Parkerpine retreated into the hotel. Not half an hour before, he had been invited to sign his name in the book lying on the desk. There it was, a neat signature, C. Parkerpine, London. A few lines above, Mr. Parkerpine noticed the entries Mrs. R. Chester, Mr. Basil Chester, Holme Park, Devon. Seizing a pen, Mr. Parkerpine wrote rapidly over his signature. It now read, with difficulty, Christopher Pine. If Mrs. R. Chester was unhappy in Polenta Bay, it was not going to be made easy for her to consult Mr. Parkerpine. Already it had been a source of abiding wonder to that gentleman that so many people he had come across abroad should know his name and have noted his advertisements. In England, many thousands of people read the Times every day and could have answered quite truthfully that they had never heard such a name in their lives. Abroad, he reflected, they read their newspapers more thoroughly. No item, not even the advertisement columns, escaped them. Already his holidays had been interrupted on several occasions. He had dealt with a whole series of problems, from murder to attempted blackmail. He was determined, in Majorca, to have peace. He felt instinctively that a distressed mother might trouble that peace considerably. Mr. Parkerpine settled down at the Pino d'Oro very happily. There was a larger hotel not far off, the Mariposa, where a good many English people stayed. There was also quite an artist colony, living all around. You could walk along by the sea to the fishing village, where there was a cocktail bar, where people met. There were a few shops. It was all very peaceful and pleasant. Girls strolled about in trousers with brightly coloured handkerchiefs tied round the upper halves of their bodies. Young men in berets, with rather long hair, held forth in Mac's bar on such subjects as plastic values and abstraction in art. On the day after Mr. Parkerpine's arrival, Mrs. Chester made a few conventional remarks to him on the subject of the view and the likelihood of the weather keeping fine. She then chatted a little with the German lady about knitting, and had a few pleasant words about the sadness of the political situation with two Danish gentlemen who spent their time rising at dawn and walking for 11 hours. Mr. Parkerpine found Basil Chester a most likeable young man. He called Mr. Parkerpine sir, and listened most politely to anything the older man said. Sometimes the three English people had coffee together after dinner in the evening. After the third day, Basil left the party after 10 minutes or so, and Mr. Parkerpine was left tête-à-tête with Mrs. Chester. They talked about flowers, and the growing of them, of the lamentable state of the English pound, and of how expensive France had become, and of the difficulty of getting good afternoon tea. Every evening when her son departed, Mr. Parkerpine saw the quickly concealed tremor of her lips, but immediately she recovered and discoursed pleasantly on the above-mentioned subjects. Little by little she began to talk of Basil, of how well he had done at school. He was in the first 11, you know. Of how everyone liked him, of how proud his father would have been of the boy had he lived, of how thankful she had been that Basil had never been wild. Of course, I always urge him to be with young people, but he really seems to prefer being with me. She said it with a kind of nice, modest pleasure in the fact, But for once, Mr. Parkerpine did not make the usual tactful response he could usually achieve so easily. He said instead,
"Oh, well, there seem to be plenty of young people here. Not in the hotel, but round about."
At that, he noticed, Mrs. Chester stiffened. She said, "Of course, there were a lot of artists. Perhaps she was very old-fashioned. Real art, of course, was different. But a lot of young people just made that sort of thing an excuse for lounging about and doing nothing, and the girls drank a lot too much."
On the following day, Basil said to Mr. Parkerpine, "I'm awfully glad you turned up here, sir, especially for my mother's sake. She likes having you to talk to in the evenings."
What did you do when you were first here?"
"As a matter of fact, we used to play piquet."
"I see.
Of course, one gets rather tired of piquet.
As a matter of fact, I've got some friends here. Frightfully cheery crowd. I didn't really think my mother approves of them."
He laughed, as though he felt this ought to be amusing.
"The mater's very old-fashioned. Even girls in trousers shock her."
"Quite so," said Mr. Parkerpine.
"What I tell her is, one's got to move with the times. The girls at home round us are frightfully dull."
"I see," said Mr. Parkerpine.
All this interested him well enough. He was a spectator of a miniature drama, but he was not called upon to take part in it. And then the worst, from Mr. Parkerpine's point of view, happened. A gushing lady of his acquaintance came to stay at the Mariposa. They met in the tea shop in the presence of Mrs. Chester. The newcomer screamed,
"Why, if it isn't Mr. Parkerpine, the one and only Mr. Parkerpine and Adela Chester! Do you know each other?" "Oh, you do. You're staying at the same hotel. He's the one and only original wizard, Adela. The marvel of the century. All your troubles smoothed out while you wait. Didn't you know? Oh, you must have heard about him. Haven't you read his advertisements? Are you in trouble? Consult Mr. Parkerpine. There's just nothing he can't do. Husbands and wives fly at each other's throats and he brings them together. If you've lost interest in life, he gives you the most thrilling adventures. As I say, the man's just a wizard."
It went on a good deal longer, Mr. Parkerpine at intervals making modest disclaimers. He disliked the look that Mrs. Chester turned upon him. He disliked even more seeing her return along the beach in close confabulation with the garrulous singer of his praises. The climax came quicker than he expected. That evening after coffee, Mrs. Chester said abruptly,
"Will you come into the little salon, Mr. Pine? There is something I want to say to you."
He could but bow and submit. Mrs. Chester's self-control had been wearing thin. As the door of the little salon closed behind them, it snapped. She sat down and burst into tears.
"My boy, Mr. Parkerpine, you must save him. We must save him. It's breaking my heart."
"My dear lady, as a mere outsider..."
"Nina Wycherley says you can do anything. She said I was to have the utmost confidence in you. She advised me to tell you everything, and that you'd put the whole thing right."
Inwardly, Mr. Parkerpine cursed the obtrusive Mrs. Wycherley. Resigning himself, he said,
"Well, let us thrash the matter out. A girl, I suppose."
"Did he tell you about her?"
"Only indirectly."
Words poured in a vehement stream from Mrs. Chester.
"The girl was dreadful. She drank, she swore, she wore no clothes to speak of. Her sister lived out here, was married to an artist, a Dutchman. The whole set was most undesirable. Half of them were living together without being married. Basil was completely changed. He'd always been so quiet, so interested in serious subjects. He had thought at one time of taking up archaeology."
"Well, well," said Mr. Parkerpine, "nature will have her revenge."
"What do you mean?"
"It isn't healthy for a young man to be interested in serious subjects. He ought to be making an idiot of himself over one girl after another."
"Please be serious, Mr. Pine."
"I'm perfectly serious. Is the young lady, by any chance, the one who had tea with you yesterday?"
He had noticed her. Her grey flannel trousers, the scarlet handkerchief tied loosely around her breast, the vermilion mouth, and the fact that she had chosen a cocktail in preference to tea.
"You saw her? Terrible. Not the kind of girl Basil has ever admired."
"You haven't given him much chance to admire a girl, have you?"
"I?
He's been too fond of your company. Bad. However, I dare say he'll get over this, if you don't precipitate matters. You don't understand. He wants to marry this girl. Betty Gregg. They're engaged. It's gone as far as that. Yes, Mr. Parkerpine, you must do something. You must get my boy out of this disastrous marriage. His whole life will be ruined. Nobody's life can be ruined, except by themselves. Basil's will be, said Mrs. Chester positively. I'm not worrying about Basil. You're not worrying about the girl. No, I'm worrying about you. You've been squandering your birthright. Mrs. Chester looked at him, slightly taken aback. What are the years from 20 to 40? Fettered and bound by personal and emotional relationships. That's bound to be, that's living. But later, there's a new stage. You can think, observe life, discover something about other people and the truth about yourself. Life becomes real, significant. You see it as a whole, not just one scene, the scene you as an actor are playing. No man or woman is actually himself or herself till after 45. That's when individuality has a chance. Mrs. Chester said, I've been wrapped up in Basil. He's been everything to me. Well, he shouldn't have been. That's what you're paying for now. Love him as much as you like, but you're Adela Chester, remember, a person, not just Basil's mother. It will break my heart if Basil's life is ruined, said Basil's mother. He looked at the delicate lines of her face, the wistful droop of her mouth. She was, somehow, a lovable woman. He did not want her to be hurt. He said, I'll see what I can do. He found Basil Chester only too ready to talk, eager to urge his point of view. This business is being just hellish. Mother's hopeless, prejudiced, narrow-minded. If only she'd let herself, she'd see how fine Betty is. And Betty? He sighed. Betty's being damn difficult. If she'd just conform a bit, I mean, leave off the lipstick for a day, it might make all the difference. She seems to go out of her way to be, well, modern when Mother's about. Mr. Parkerpine smiled. Betty and Mother are two of the dearest people in the world. I should have thought they would have taken to each other like hot cakes. You have a lot to learn, young man, said Mr. Parkerpine. I wish you'd come along and see Betty and have a good talk about it all. Mr. Parkerpine accepted the invitation readily. Betty and her sister and her husband lived in a small, dilapidated villa a little way back from the sea. Their life was of a refreshing simplicity. Their furniture comprised 3 chairs, a table, and beds. There was a cupboard in the wall that held the bare requirements of cups and plates. Hans was an excitable young man, with wild blonde hair that stood up all over his head. He spoke very odd English with incredible rapidity, walking up and down as he did so. Stella, his wife, was small and fair. Betty Gregg had red hair and freckles, and a mischievous eye. She was, he noticed, not nearly so made up as she had been the previous day at the Pino d'Oro. She gave him a cocktail, and said with a twinkle, "You're in on the big bust-up?" Mr. Parkerpine nodded. "And whose side are you on, big boy? The young lovers, or the disapproving dame?" "May I ask you a question?" "Certainly." Have you been very tactful over all this? Not at all, said Miss Gregg frankly, but the old cat put my back up. She glanced round to make sure that Basil was out of earshot. That woman just makes me feel mad. She's kept Basil tied to her apron strings all these years. That sort of thing makes a man look a fool. Basil isn't a fool, really. Then she's so terribly pucker-sab. That's not really such a bad thing. It's merely unfashionable just at present. Betty Gregg gave a sudden twinkle. You mean it's like putting Chippendale chairs in the attic in Victorian days. Later you get them down again and say, aren't they marvellous? Something of the kind. Betty Gregg considered. Perhaps you're right. I'll be honest. It was Basil who put my back up.
being so anxious about what impression I'd make on his mother. It drove me to extremes. Even now, I believe he might give me up if his mother worked on him good and hard.
He might, said Mr. Parkerpine, if she went about it the right way.
Are you going to tell her the right way? She won't think of it herself, you know. She'll just go on disapproving, and that won't do the trick. But if you prompted her... She bit her lip, raised frank blue eyes to his. I've heard about you, Mr. Parkerpine. You're supposed to know something about human nature. Do you think Basil and I could make a go of it? Or not?
I should like an answer to three questions.
Suitability test? All right, go ahead.
Do you sleep with your window open or shut?
Open. I like lots of air.
Do you and Basil enjoy the same kind of food?
Yes.
Do you like going to bed early or late?
Really, under the rose early. At 10:30, I yawn, and I secretly feel rather hearty in the mornings, but of course I daren't admit it.
You ought to suit each other very well, said Mr. Parkerpine.
Rather a superficial test.
Not at all. I have known 7 marriages, at least, entirely wrecked because the husband liked sitting up till midnight and the wife fell asleep at 9:30, and vice versa.
It's a pity, said Betty, that everybody can't be happy, Basil and I, and his mother giving us her blessing. Mr. Parkerpine coughed.
I think, he said, that could possibly be managed.
She looked at him doubtfully. Now, I wonder, she said, if you're double-crossing me. Mr. Parkerpine's face told nothing. To Mrs. Chester, he was soothing but vague. An engagement was not marriage. He himself was going to Solaire for a week. He suggested that her line of action should be non-committal. Let her appear to acquiesce. He spent a very enjoyable week at Solaire. On his return, he found that a totally unexpected development had arisen. As he entered the Pino d'Oro, the first thing he saw was Mrs. Chester and Betty Gregg having tea together. Basil was not there. Mrs. Chester looked haggard. Betty, too, was looking off colour. She was hardly made up at all, and her eyelids looked as though she had been crying. They greeted him in a friendly fashion, but neither of them mentioned Basil. Suddenly, he heard the girl beside him draw in her breath sharply as though something had hurt her. Mr. Parkerpine turned his head. Basil Chester was coming up the steps from the seafront. With him was a girl so exotically beautiful that it quite took your breath away. She was dark, and her figure was marvellous. No one could fail to notice the fact, since she wore nothing but a single garment of pale blue crepe. She was heavily made up with ochre powder and an orange scarlet mouth. But the unguents only displayed her remarkable beauty in a more pronounced fashion. As for young Basil, he seemed unable to take his eyes from her face.
You're very late, Basil, said his mother. You were to have taken Betty to Max.
My fault, drawled the beautiful unknown. We just drifted. She turned to Basil. Angel, get me something with a kick in it.
She tossed off her shoe and stretched out her manicured toenails, which were done emerald green to match her fingernails. She paid no attention to the two women, but she leaned a little towards Mr. Parkerpine.
Terrible island, this, she said. I was just dying with boredom before I met Basil. He is rather a pet.
Mr. Parkerpine, Miss Ramona, said Mrs. Chester.
The girl acknowledged the introduction with a lazy smile.
I guess I'll call you Parker almost at once, she murmured. My name's Dolores.
Basil returned with the drinks. Miss Ramona divided her conversation, what there was of it, it was mostly glances, between Basil and Mr. Parkerpine. Of the two women she took no notice whatever. Betty attempted once or twice to join in the conversation, but the other girl merely stared at her and yawned. Suddenly Dolores rose.
Guess I'll be going along now. I'm at the other hotel. Anyone coming to see me home?
Basil sprang up.
I'll come with you.
Mrs. Chester said, "Basil, my dear, I'll be back presently, Mother." "Isn't he the mother's boy?" Miss Ramona asked of the world at large. "Just toots around after her, don't you?" Basil flushed and looked awkward. Miss Ramona gave a nod in Mrs. Chester's direction, a dazzling smile to Mr. Parker Pine, and she and Basil moved off together. After they had gone, there was rather an awkward silence. Mr. Parker Pine did not like to speak first. Betty Gregg was twisting her fingers and looking out to sea. Mrs. Chester looked flushed and angry. Betty said, "Well, what do you think of our new acquisition at Pollensa Bay?" Her voice was not quite steady. Mr. Parker Pine said cautiously, "A little, exotic?" "Exotic?" Betty gave a short, bitter laugh. Mrs. Chester said, "She's terrible, terrible. Basil must be quite mad." Betty said sharply, "Oh, Basil's all right." "Her toenails," said Mrs. Chester with a shiver of nausea. Betty rose suddenly. "I think, Mrs. Chester, I'll go home and not stay to dinner after all." "Oh, my dear, Basil will be so disappointed." "Will he?" asked Betty with a short laugh. "Anyway, I think I will. I've got rather a headache." She smiled at them both and went off. Mrs. Chester turned to Mr. Parker Pine. "I wish we'd never come to this place. Never." Mr. Parker Pine shook his head sadly. "You shouldn't have gone away," said Mrs. Chester. "If you'd been here, this wouldn't have happened." Mr. Parker Pine was stung to respond, "My dear lady, I can assure you that when it comes to a question of a beautiful young woman, I should have no influence over your son whatever. He seems to be of a very susceptible nature."
"He never used to be," said Mrs. Chester tearfully.
"Well," said Mr. Parker Pine with an attempt at cheerfulness, "this new attraction seems to have broken the back of his infatuation for Miss Gregg. That must be some satisfaction to you."
"I don't know what you mean," said Mrs. Chester. "Betty is a dear child, and devoted to Basil. She's behaving extremely well over this. I think my boy must be mad."
Mr. Parker Pine received this startling change of face without wincing. He had met inconsistency in women before. He said mildly,
"Not exactly mad, just bewitched.
The creature's impossible,
but extremely good-looking."
Mrs. Chester snorted. Basil ran up the steps from the seafront.
"Hello, Mater. Here I am. Where's Betty?"
"Betty's gone home with a headache. I don't wonder."
"Sulking, you mean?"
"I consider, Basil, that you are being extremely unkind to Betty. Oh, for God's sake, Mother, don't jaw.
If Betty's going to make this fuss every time I speak to another girl, a nice sort of life we'll lead together."
"You are engaged."
"Oh, we're engaged, all right. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to have any friends of our own. Nowadays, people have to lead their own lives and try to cut out jealousy."
He paused.
"Look here. If Betty isn't going to dine with us, I think I'll go back to the Mariposa. They did ask me to dine."
"Oh, Basil!"
The boy gave her an exasperated look, then ran off down the steps. Mrs. Chester looked eloquently at Mr. Parker Pine.
"You see?" she said.
He saw. Matters came to a head a couple of days later. Betty and Basil were to have gone for a long walk, taking a picnic lunch with them. Betty arrived at the Pino d'Oro to find that Basil had forgotten the plan and gone over to Formentor for the day with Dolores Ramona's party. Beyond a tightening of the lips, the girl made no sign. Presently, however, she got up and stood in front of Mrs. Chester. The two women were alone on the terrace.
"It's quite all right," she said. "It doesn't matter, but I think, all the same, that we'd better call the whole thing off."
She slipped from her finger the signet ring that Basil had given her. He would buy the real engagement ring later.
"Will you give him back this, Mrs. Chester? And tell him it's all right. Not to worry."
"Betty, dear, don't. He does love you, really."
"It looks like it, doesn't it?" said the girl with a short laugh.
"No,
I've got some pride. Tell him everything's all right and that I wish him luck.
When Basil returned at sunset, he was greeted by a storm. He flushed a little at the sight of his ring.
So, that's how she feels, is it? Well, I dare say it's the best thing.
Basil! Well, frankly, Mother, we don't seem to have been hitting it off lately. And whose fault was that?
I don't see that it was mine, particularly.
Jealousy's beastly, and I really don't see why you should get all worked up about it. You begged me yourself not to marry Betty. That was before I knew her, Basil. My dear, you're not thinking of marrying this other creature.
Basil Chester said soberly, I'd marry her like a shot if she'd have me. But I'm afraid she won't.
Cold chills went down Mrs. Chester's spine. She sought and found Mr. Parker Pyne placidly reading a book in a sheltered corner.
You must do something. You must do something. My boy's life will be ruined.
Mr. Parker Pyne was getting a little tired of Basil Chester's life being ruined.
What can I do? Go and see this terrible creature. If necessary, buy her off.
That may come very expensive.
I don't care.
It seems a pity. Still, there are possibly other ways.
She looked a question. He shook his head.
I'll make no promises, but I'll see what I can do. I have handled that kind of thing before. By the way, not a word to Basil. That would be fatal.
Oh, of course not.
Mr. Parker Pyne returned from the Mariposa at midnight. Mrs. Chester was sitting up for him.
Well?
She demanded breathlessly. His eyes twinkled.
The Senorita Dolores Ramona will leave Polenza tomorrow morning, and the island tomorrow night.
Oh, Mr. Parker Pyne, how did you manage it?
It won't cost a cent, said Mr. Parker Pyne.
Again his eyes twinkled.
I rather fancied I might have a hold over her, and I was right.
You are wonderful. Nina Wycherley was quite right. You must let me know your fees.
Mr. Parker Pyne held up a well-manicured hand.
Not a penny. It has been a pleasure. I hope all will go well. Of course, the boy will be very upset at first when he finds she's disappeared and left no address. Just go easy with him for a week or two.
If only Betty will forgive him.
Oh, she'll forgive him, all right. They're a nice couple. By the way, I'm leaving tomorrow, too.
Oh, Mr. Parker Pyne, we shall miss you.
Perhaps it's just as well I should go before that boy of yours gets infatuated with yet a third girl.
Mr. Parker Pyne leaned over the rail of the steamer and looked at the lights of Palma. Beside him stood Dolores Ramona. He was saying appreciatively,
A very nice piece of work, Madeline. I'm glad I wired you to come out. It's odd when you're such a quiet, stay-at-home girl, really.
Madeline de Sara, alias Dolores Ramona, alias Maggie Sayers, said primly,
I'm glad you're pleased, Mr. Parker Pyne. It's been a nice little change. I think I'll go below now and get to bed before the boat starts. I'm such a bad sailor.
A few minutes later, a hand fell on Mr. Parker Pyne's shoulder. He turned to see Basil Chester.
Had to come and see you off, Mr. Parker Pyne, and give you Betty's love, and her and my best thanks. It was a grand stunt of yours.
Betty and Mother are as thick as thieves. Seemed ashamed to deceive the old darling, but she was being difficult. Anyway, it's all right now.
I must just be careful to keep up the annoyance stuff a couple of days longer.
We're no end grateful to you, Betty and I.
I wish you every happiness, said Mr. Parker Pyne.
Thanks.
There was a pause. Then Basil said with somewhat overdone carelessness,
Is Miss de Sara anywhere about? I'd like to thank her, too.
Mr. Parker Pyne shot a keen glance at him. He said,
I'm afraid Mr. Sara's gone to bed.
Oh, too bad.
Well,
Perhaps I'll see her in London sometime. As a matter of fact, she is going to America on business for me almost at once.
Oh. Basil's tone was blank.
Well, he said, I'll be getting along.
Mr. Parkerpine smiled. On his way to his cabin, he tapped on the door of Madeline's.
How are you, my dear?
All right.
Our young friend has been along.
The usual slight attack of Madelineitis.
He'll get over it in a day or two. But you are rather distracting.
The Second Gong. Joan Ashby came out of her bedroom and stood a moment on the landing outside her door. She was half turning as if to go back into the room when, below her feet, as it seemed, a gong boomed out. Immediately, Joan started forward, almost at a run. So great was her hurry that at the top of the big staircase she collided with a young man arriving from the opposite direction.
Hello, Joan. Why the wild hurry?
Sorry, Harry. I didn't see you.
So I gathered, said Harry Dalehouse dryly. But as I say, why the wild haste?
It was the gong.
I know, but it's only the first gong.
No, it's the second.
First?
Second.
Thus arguing, they had been descending the stairs. They were now in the hall, where the butler, having replaced the gong stick, was advancing toward them at a grave and dignified pace.
It's the second, persisted Joan. I know it is.
Well, for one thing, look at the time.
Harry Dalehouse glanced up at the grandfather clock.
Oh, just 8:12, he remarked.
Joan, I believe you're right.
But I never heard the first one.
Digby, he addressed the butler, is this the first gong or the second?
The first, sir.
At 8:12?
Digby, somebody will get the sack for this. A faint smile showed for a minute on the butler's face.
Dinner is being served 10 minutes later tonight, sir. The master's orders.
Incredible! Cried Harry Dalehouse. Tut, tut! Upon my word! Things are coming to a pretty pass. Wonders will never cease. What ails my revered uncle?
The 7 o'clock train, sir, was 30 minutes late, and as...
The butler broke off, as a sound like the crack of a whip was heard.
What on earth? Said Harry. Why, that sounded exactly like a shot.
A dark, handsome man of 35 came out of the drawing-room on their left.
What was that? He asked. It sounded exactly like a shot.
It must have been a car backfiring, sir, said the butler.
The road runs quite close to the house this side, and the upstairs windows are open.
Perhaps, said Joan doubtfully. But that would be over there.
She waved a hand to the right.
And I thought the noise came from here.
She pointed to the left. The dark man shook his head.
I don't think so. I was in the drawing room. I came out here because I thought the noise came from this direction.
He nodded his head in front of him, in the direction of the gong and the front door.
East, west, and south, eh? Said the irrepressible Harry. Well, I'll make it complete, Keen. North for me. I thought it came from behind us. Any solutions offered?
Well, there's always murder, said Geoffrey Keane, smiling.
I beg your pardon, Miss Ashby.
Only a shiver, said Joan. It's nothing.
What you call it, walking over my grave.
Good thought, murder, said Harry.
But alas, no groans, no blood. I fear the solution is a poacher after a rabbit.
Seems tame, but I suppose that's it, agreed the other. But it sounded so near. However, let's come into the drawing-room.
Thank goodness we're not late, said Joan fervently. I was simply hearing it down the stairs, thinking that was the second gong.
All laughing, they went into the big drawing-room. Litcham Close was one of the most famous old houses in England. Its owner, Hubert Litcham Roche, was the last of a long line, and his more distant relatives were apt to remark that old Hubert, you know, really ought to be certified. Mad as a hatter, poor old bird. Allowing for the exaggeration, natural to friends and relatives, some truth remained. Hubert Litcham Roche was certainly eccentric. Though a very fine musician, he was a man of ungovernable temper
and had an almost abnormal sense of his own importance. People staying in the house had to respect his prejudices, or else they were never asked again. One such prejudice was his music. If he played to his guests, as he often did in the evening, absolute silence must obtain. A whispered comment, a rustle of a dress, a movement even, and he would turn round scowling fiercely, and goodbye to the unlucky guest's chances of being asked again. Another point was absolute punctuality for the crowning meal of the day. Breakfast was immaterial. You might come down at noon if you wished. Lunch also, a simple meal of cold meats and stewed fruit. But dinner was a rite, a festival, prepared by a cordon bleu whom he had tempted from a big hotel by the payment of a fabulous salary. A first gong was sounded at 8:05. At 8:15, a second gong was heard, and immediately after the door was flung open, dinner announced to the assembled guests, and a solemn procession wended its way to the dining room. Anyone who had the temerity to be late for the second gong was henceforth excommunicated, and Litcham Close shut to the unlucky diner forever. Hence the anxiety of Joan Ashby, and also the astonishment of Harry Dalehouse at hearing that the sacred function was to be delayed 10 minutes on this particular evening. Though not very intimate with his uncle, he had been to Litcham Close often enough to know what a very unusual occurrence that was. Geoffrey Keane, who was Litcham Roche's secretary, was also very much surprised. "Extraordinary," he commented. "I've never known such a thing to happen. Are you sure?" "Digby said so."
"He said something about a train," said Joan Ashby. "At least I think so."
"Queer," said Keane thoughtfully. "We shall hear all about it in due course, I suppose, but it's very odd." Both men were silent for a moment or two, watching the girl. Joan Ashby was a charming creature, blue-eyed and golden-haired, with an impish glance. This was her first visit to Litcham Close, and her invitation was at Harry's prompting. The door opened, and Diana Cleves, the Litcham Roche's adopted daughter, came into the room. There was a daredevil grace about Diana, a witchery in her dark eyes and her mocking tongue. Nearly all men fell for Diana, and she enjoyed her conquests. A strange creature, with her alluring suggestion of warmth and her complete coldness. "Beaten the old man for once," she remarked. "First time for weeks he hasn't been here first, looking at his watch and tramping up and down like a tiger at feeding time." The young man had sprung forward. She smiled entrancingly at them both, then turned to Harry. Geoffrey Keane's dark cheek flushed as he dropped back. He recovered himself, however, a moment later as Mrs. Litcham Roche came in. She was a tall, dark woman, naturally vague in manner, wearing floating draperies of an indeterminate shade of green. With her was a middle-aged man with a beak-like nose and a determined chin, Gregory Barling. He was a somewhat prominent figure in the financial world, and well-bred on his mother's side, he had for some years been an intimate friend of Hubert Litcham Roche. Boom! The gong resounded imposingly. As it died away, the door was flung open, and Digby announced, "Dinner is served." Then, well-trained servant though he was, a look of complete astonishment flashed over his impassive face. For the first time in his memory, his master was not in the room. That his astonishment was shared by everybody was evident. Mrs. Litcham Roche gave a little uncertain laugh.
"Most amazing, really. I don't know what to do."
Everybody was taken aback. The whole tradition of Litcham Close was undermined. What could have happened? Conversation ceased. There was a strained sense of waiting. At last the door opened once more. A sigh of relief went round, only tempered by a slight anxiety as to how to treat the situation. Nothing must be said to emphasize the fact that the host had himself transgressed the stringent rule of the house. But the newcomer was not Litcham Roche. Instead of the big, bearded, Viking-like figure, there advanced into the long drawing-room a very small man, palpably a foreigner, with an egg-shaped head, a flamboyant moustache, and most irreproachable evening clothes. His eyes twinkling, the newcomer advanced towards Mrs. Litcham Roche.
"My apologies, madame,"
he said.
I am, I fear, a few minutes late.
Oh, not at all, murmured Mrs. Litcham Roche, vaguely. Not at all, Mr... She paused.
Poirot, madame. Hercule Poirot.
He heard behind him a very soft, oh, a gasp, rather than an articulate word, a woman's ejaculation. Perhaps he was flattered.
You knew I was coming, he murmured gently, n'est-ce pas, madame? Your husband told you.
Oh, yes, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, her manner unconvincing in the extreme.
I suppose so. I am so terribly unpractical, Monsieur Poirot. I never remember anything, but fortunately Digby sees to everything.
My train, I fear, was late, said Monsieur Poirot. An accident on the line in front of us.
Oh,
cried Joan.
So that's why dinner was put off.
His eye came quickly round to her, a most uncannily discerning eye.
That is something out of the usual, huh?
I really can't think, began Mrs. Litcham Roche, and then stopped.
I mean,
she went on confusedly,
it's so odd. Hubert never...
Poirot's eyes swept rapidly round the group.
Monsieur Litcham Roche is not down yet?
No, and it's so extraordinary. She looked appealingly at Geoffrey Keane. A Mr. Litcham Roche is the soul of punctuality, explained Keane. He has not been late for dinner for, well, I don't know that he was ever late before. To a stranger, the situation must have been ludicrous. The perturbed faces, and the general consternation.
I know, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, with the air of one solving a problem. I shall ring for Digby.
She suited the action to the word. The butler came promptly.
Digby, said Mrs. Litcham Roche, your master, is he...
As was customary with her, she did not finish her sentence. It was clear that the butler did not expect her to do so. He replied promptly, and with understanding.
Mr. Litcham Roche came down at 8:05, and went into the study, madam.
Oh, she paused. You don't think... I mean, he heard the gong?
I think he must have. The gong is immediately outside the study door.
Yes, of course. Of course,
said Mrs. Litcham Roche more vaguely than ever.
Shall I inform him, madam, that dinner is ready?
Oh, thank you, Digby. Yes, I think, yes, I should.
I don't know, said Mrs. Litcham Roche to her guests as the butler withdrew,
what I would do without Digby.
A pause followed. Then Digby re-entered the room. His breath was coming a little faster than is considered good form in a butler.
"Excuse me, madam. The study door is locked."
It was then that Monsieur Hercule Poirot took command of the situation.
"I think," he said, "that we had better go to the study."
He led the way, and everyone followed. His assumption of authority seemed perfectly natural. He was no longer a rather comic-looking guest. He was a personality, and master of the situation. He led the way out into the hall, past the staircase, past the great clock, past the recess in which stood the gong. Exactly opposite that recess was a closed door. He tapped on it, first gently, then with increasing violence, but there was no reply. Very nimbly, he dropped to his knees and applied his eye to the keyhole. He rose and looked around.
Monsieur, he said,
we must break open this door, immediately.
As before, no one questioned his authority. Geoffrey Keane and Gregory Barling were the two biggest men. They attacked the door under Poirot's directions. It was no easy matter. The doors of Litcham Close were solid affairs. No modern jerry-building here. It resisted the attack valiantly, but at last it gave before the united attack of the men and crashed inward. The house party hesitated in the doorway. They saw what they had subconsciously feared to see. Facing them was the window. On the left, between the door and the window, was a big writing table. Sitting,
Not at the table, but sideways to it, was a man. A big man. Slouched forward in the chair. His back was to them and his face to the window, but his position told the tale. His right hand hung limply down, and below it, on the carpet, was a small, shining pistol. Poirot spoke sharply to Gregory Barling.
"Take Mrs. Litcham Roche away, and the other two ladies."
The other nodded comprehendingly. He laid a hand on his hostess's arm. She shivered.
He has shot himself, she murmured. Horrible.
With another shiver, she permitted him to lead her away. The two girls followed. Poirot came forward into the room, the two young men behind him. He knelt down by the body, motioning them to keep back a little. He found the bullet hole on the right side of the head. It had passed out the other side and had evidently struck a mirror hanging on the left-hand wall, since this was shivered. On the writing table was a sheet of paper, blank, save for the word "sorry," scrawled across it in hesitating, shaky writing. Poirot's eyes darted back to the door.
"The key is not in the lock," he said. "I wonder."
His hand slid into the dead man's pocket.
"Here it is," he said.
"At least I think so. Have the goodness to try it, monsieur."
Geoffrey Keane took it from him and tried it in the lock.
"That's it, all right."
"And the window?"
Harry Dalehouse strode across to it.
"Shut." "You permit?"
Very swiftly, Poirot scrambled to his feet and joined the other at the window. It was a long French window. Poirot opened it, stood a minute scrutinizing the grass just in front of it, then closed it again.
"My friends," he said, "we must telephone for the police. Until they have come and satisfied themselves that it is truly suicide, nothing must be touched. Death can only have occurred about a quarter of an hour ago."
"I know," said Harry hoarsely. "We heard the shot."
"Comment? What is that you say?"
Harry explained with the help of Geoffrey Keane. As he finished speaking, Barling reappeared. Poirot repeated what he had said before, and while Keane went off to telephone, Poirot requested Barling to give him a few minutes' interview. They went into a small morning room, leaving Digby on guard outside the study door, while Harry went off to find the ladies.
"You were, I understand, an intimate friend of Monsieur Litcham Roche," began Poirot. "It is for that reason that I address myself to you primarily. In etiquette, perhaps I should have spoken first to Madame, but at the moment, I do not think that is pratique."
He paused.
"I am, you see, in a delicate situation. I will lay the facts plainly before you. I am, by profession, a private detective."
The financier smiled a little.
"It's not necessary to tell me that, Monsieur Poirot. Your name is, by now, a household word."
"Monsieur is too amiable," said Poirot, bowing. "Let us then proceed. I receive, at my London address, a letter from this Monsieur Litcham Roche. In it he says that he has reason to believe that he is being swindled of large sums of money. For family reasons, so he puts it, he does not wish to call in the police, but he desires that I should come down and look into the matter for him."
"Well, I agree. I come. Not quite so soon as Mr. Litcham Roche wishes, for after all I have other affairs. And Monsieur Litcham Roche, he is not quite the King of England, though he seems to think he is."
Barling gave a wry smile.
He did think of himself that way.
"Exactly. You comprehend, his letter showed plainly enough that he was what one calls an eccentric. He was not insane, but he was unbalanced, n'est-ce pas?"
"What he's just done ought to show that."
"Oh, monsieur, but suicide is not always the act of the unbalanced. The coroner's jury, they say so, but that is to spare the feelings of those left behind."
"Hubert was not a normal individual," said Barling decisively. "He was given to ungovernable rages, was a monomaniac on the subject of family pride, and had a bee in his bonnet in more ways than one.
But for all that, he was a shrewd man. Precisely. He was sufficiently shrewd to discover that he was being robbed.
Does a man commit suicide because he's being robbed? Barling asked.
As you say, monsieur, ridiculous. And that brings me to the need for haste in the matter. For family reasons. That was the phrase he used in his letter. Eh bien, monsieur, you are a man of the world. You know that it is for precisely that, family reasons, that a man does commit suicide.
You mean that it looks, on the face of it, as if ce pauvre monsieur had found out something further, and was unable to face what he had found out.
But you perceive I have a duty. I am already employed, commissioned. I have accepted the task, this family reason. The dead man did not want it to get to the police, so I must act quickly. I must learn the truth.
And when you have learned it?
Then I must use my discretion. I must do what I can.
I see, said Barling. He smoked for a minute or two in silence. Then he said,
All the same, I'm afraid I can't help you. Hubert never confided anything to me. I know nothing.
But tell me, monsieur, who, should you say, had a chance of robbing this poor gentleman?
Well, difficult to say. Of course, there's the agent for the estate. He's a new man.
The agent?
Yes, Marshall. Captain Marshall. Very nice fellow. Lost an arm in the war. He came here a year ago. But Hubert liked him, I know, and trusted him too.
If it were Captain Marshall who was playing him false, there would be no family reasons for silence.
No.
The hesitation did not escape Poirot.
Speak, monsieur. Speak plainly, I beg of you.
Well, it may be gossip.
I implore you, speak.
Well, very well, then, I will. Did you notice a very attractive-looking young woman in the drawing-room?
I noticed two very attractive-looking young women.
Oh, yes, Miss Ashby. Pretty little thing. Her first visit. Harry Dalehouse got Mrs. Litcham Roche to ask her. No, I mean a dark girl. Diana Cleves.
I noticed her, said Poirot.
She is one that all men would notice, I think. She's a little devil, burst out Barling. She's played fast and loose with every man for 20 miles around. Someone will murder her one of these days.
He wiped his brow with a handkerchief, oblivious of the keen interest with which the other was regarding him.
And this young lady is... She's Litcham Roche's adopted daughter. A great disappointment when he and his wife had no children. They adopted Diana Cleves. She was some kind of cousin. Hubert was devoted to her, simply worshipped her.
Doubtless he would dislike the idea of her marrying, suggested Poirot.
Not if she married the right person.
And the right person was you, monsieur?
Barling started and flushed.
I never said...
mais non, you said nothing, but it was so, was it not?
I fell in love with her, yes. Litcham Roche was pleased about it. It fitted in with his ideas for her.
And Mademoiselle herself?
I told you, she's the devil incarnate.
I comprehend. She has her own ideas of amusement, is it not so?
But Captain Marshall, where does he come in? Well, she's been seeing a lot of him. People talked. Not that I think there's anything in it. Another scalp, that's all.
Poirot nodded.
But supposing that there had been something in it?
Well, then it might explain why Monsieur Litcham Roche wanted to proceed cautiously. You do understand, don't you, that there's no earthly reason for suspecting Marshall of defalcation?
Oh, parfaitement, parfaitement.
It might be an affair of a forged check with someone in the household involved.
This young Mr. Dalehouse, who is he?
A nephew.
He will inherit? Yes?
He's a sister's son. Of course, he might take the name. There's not a Litcham Roche left.
I see.
The place isn't actually entailed, though it's always gone from father to son. I've always imagined that he'd leave the place to his wife for her lifetime, and then perhaps to Diana, if he approved of her marriage. You see, her husband could take the name.
I comprehend, said Poirot.
You have been most kind and helpful to me, monsieur. May I ask of you one thing further? To explain to Madame Lichem Roche all that I have told you, and to beg of her that she accord me a minute?
Sooner than he had thought likely, the door opened, and Mrs. Lichem Roche entered. She floated to a chair.
Mr. Barling has explained everything to me, she said. We mustn't have any scandal, of course, though I do feel, really, it's fate. Don't you? I mean with the mirror and everything.
Comment? The mirror?
The moment I saw it, it seemed a symbol of Hubert. A curse, you know. I think old families have a curse very often. Hubert was always very strange. Lately he has been stranger than ever. You will forgive me for asking, madame, but you are not in any way short of money? Money? I never think of money.
Do you know what they say, madame?
Those who never think of money need a great deal of it.
He ventured a tiny laugh. She did not respond. Her eyes were far away.
I thank you, madame, he said,
and the interview came to an end. Poirot rang, and Digby answered.
I shall require you to answer a few questions, said Poirot. I am a private detective sent for by your master before he died.
A detective?
The butler gasped.
Why?
You will please answer my questions.
As to the shot now.
He listened to the butler's account.
So there were four of you in the hall.
Yes, sir. Mr. Dalehouse and Miss Ashby and Mr. Keane came from the drawing room.
Where were the others?
The others, sir?
Yes, Mrs. Lichem Roche, Miss Cleves, and Mr. Barling.
Mrs. Lichem Roche and Mr. Barling came down later, sir.
And Miss Cleves?
I think Miss Cleves was in the drawing room, sir. Poirot asked a few more questions, then dismissed the butler, with the command to request Miss Cleves to come to him. She came immediately, and he studied her attentively in view of Barling's revelations. She was certainly beautiful in her white satin frock with the rosebud on the shoulder. He explained the circumstances which had brought him to Lichem Close, eyeing her very closely, but she showed only what seemed to be genuine astonishment, with no signs of uneasiness. She spoke of Marshall indifferently, with tepid approval. Only at mention of Barling did she approach animation.
That man's a crook, she said sharply. I told the old man so, but he wouldn't listen. Went on putting money into his rotten concerns.
Are you sorry, mademoiselle, that your father is dead?
She stared at him.
Of course. I'm modern, you know, Monsieur Poirot. I don't indulge in sob stuff. But I was fond of the old man. Though, of course, it's best for him.
Best for him?
Yes, one of these days he would have had to be locked up. It was growing on him, this belief that the last Lichem Roche of Lichem Close was omnipotent.
Poirot nodded thoughtfully.
I see. I see.
Yes, decided signs of mental trouble. By the way, you permit that I examine your little bag?
It is charming, all those silk rosebuds.
What was I saying?
Oh, yes. Did you hear the shot?
Oh, yes. But I thought it was a car, or a poacher or something.
You were in the drawing room?
No, I was out in the garden.
I see. Thank you, mademoiselle. Next, I would like to see Monsieur Keane, is it not?
Geoffrey, I'll send him along.
Keane came in, alert and interested. Mr. Barling has been telling me of the reason for your being down here. I don't know that there's anything I can tell you, but if I can... Poirot interrupted him.
I only want to know one thing, Monsieur Keane. What was it that you stooped and picked up just before we got to the study door this evening?
I...
Keane half sprang up from his chair, then subsided again.
I don't know what you mean, he said lightly.
Oh, I think you do, monsieur.
You were behind me.
I know, but a friend of mine, he says I have eyes in the back of my head. You picked up something
and you put it in the right-hand pocket of your dinner jacket."
There was a pause. Indecision was written plainly on Keane's handsome face. At last he made up his mind. "Take your choice, Monsieur Poirot," he said, and leaning forward he turned his pocket inside out. There was a cigarette holder, a handkerchief, a tiny silk rosebud, and a little gold matchbox. A moment's silence, then Keane said, "As a matter of fact, it was this." He picked up the matchbox. "I must have dropped it earlier in the evening."
"I think not," said Poirot.
"What do you mean?"
"What I say. I, monsieur, am a man of tidiness, of method, of order. A matchbox on the ground, I should see it and pick it up. A matchbox of this size, assuredly I should see it." "No, monsieur. I think it was something very much smaller. Such as this, perhaps."
He picked up the little silk rosebud.
"From Miss Cleave's bag, I think."
There was a moment's pause. Then Keane admitted it with a laugh.
"Yes, that's so. She gave it to me last night."
"I see," said Poirot. And at the moment the door opened, and a tall, fair-haired man in a lounge suit strode into the room.
"Keane, what's all this? Litcham Roche shot himself? Man, I can't believe it. It's incredible."
"Let me introduce you," said Keane, "to Monsieur Hercule Poirot." The other started. "He will tell you all about it." And he left the room, banging the door.
"Monsieur Poirot?"
John Marshall was all eagerness. "I'm most awfully pleased to meet you. It's a bit of luck your being down here. Litcham Roche never told me you were coming. I'm a most frightful admirer of yours, sir." A disarming young man, thought Poirot. Not so young either, for there was grey hair at the temples and lines on the forehead. It was the voice and manner that gave the impression of boyishness.
"The police,
they're here now, sir. I came up with them on hearing the news. They don't seem particularly surprised. Of course, he was mad as a hatter, but even then..."
"Even then, you are surprised at his committing suicide?"
"Frankly, yes. I shouldn't have thought that, well, that Litcham Roche could have imagined the world getting on without him."
"He has had money troubles of late, I understand."
Marshall nodded. "He speculated. Wildcat schemes of Barling's." Poirot said quietly,
"I will be frank. Had you any reason to suppose that Mr. Litcham Roche suspected you of tampering with your accounts?"
Marshall stared at Poirot in a kind of ludicrous bewilderment. So ludicrous was it that Poirot was forced to smile.
"I see that you are utterly taken aback, Captain Marshall."
"Yes, indeed. The idea is ridiculous."
"Ah, another question. He did not suspect you of robbing him of his adopted daughter?"
"Oh. So you know about me and I?" He laughed in an embarrassed fashion.
"It is so, then?"
Marshall nodded. "But the old man didn't know anything about it. Di wouldn't have him told. I suppose she was right. He'd have gone up like a basket full of rockets. I should have been chucked out of a job, and that would have been that."
"And instead, what was your plan?"
"Well, upon my word, sir, I hardly know. I left things to Di. She said she'd fix it. As a matter of fact, I was looking out for a job. If I could have got one, I'd have chucked this up."
"And Mademoiselle would have married you. But Monsieur Litcham Roche might have stopped her allowance. Mademoiselle Diana is, I should say, fond of money."
Marshall looked rather uncomfortable. "Well, I'd have tried to make it up to her, sir." Geoffrey Keane came into the room. "The police are just going and would like to see you, Monsieur Poirot."
"Merci. I will come."
In the study were a stalwart inspector and the police surgeon.
"Monsieur Poirot," said the inspector. "We've heard of you, sir. I'm Inspector Reeves."
"You are most amiable," said Poirot, shaking hands. "You do not need my cooperation, no?"
He gave a little laugh.
Not this time, sir. All plain sailing."
"The case is perfectly straightforward, then?" demanded Poirot.
"Absolutely. Door and window locked. Key of door in dead man's pocket.
Manner very strange the past few days, no doubt about it.
Everything quite natural?
The doctor grunted. Yeah. Must have been sitting at a damn queer angle for the bullet to have hit that mirror. But suicide's a queer business.
You found the bullet?
Yes, here. The doctor held it out. Near the wall, below the mirror. Pistol was Mr. Roche's own. Kept it in the drawer of the desk, always. Something behind it all, I dare say. But what that is, we shall never know. Poirot nodded. The body had been carried to a bedroom. The police now took their leave. Poirot stood at the front door, looking after them. A sound made him turn. Harry Dalehouse was close behind him.
"Have you, by any chance, a strong flashlight, my friend?" asked Poirot.
"Oh, yes. I'll get it for you." When he returned with it, Joan Ashby was with him.
"You may accompany me if you like," said Poirot graciously.
He stepped out of the front door and turned to the right, stopping before the study window. About 6 feet of grass separated it from the path. Poirot bent down, playing the flashlight on the grass. He straightened himself and shook his head.
"No," he said, "not there."
Then he paused, and slowly his figure stiffened. On either side of the grass was a deep flower border. Poirot's attention was focused on the right-hand border, full of Michaelmas daisies and dahlias. His torch was directed on the front of the bed. Distinct, on the soft mould, were footprints.
4 of them, murmured Poirot. 2 going toward the window, 2 coming from it.
A gardener, suggested Joan.
But no, mademoiselle, but no. Employ your eyes. These shoes are small, dainty, high-heeled. The shoes are a woman. Mademoiselle Diana mentioned having been out in the garden. Do you know if she went downstairs before you did, mademoiselle?
Joan shook her head.
I can't remember. I was in such a hurry because the gong went, and I thought I'd heard the first one. I do seem to remember that her room door was open as I went past, but I'm not sure. Mrs. Litcham Roche's was shut, I know.
I see, said Poirot. Something in his voice made Harry look up sharply. But Poirot was merely frowning gently to himself. In the doorway they met Diana Cleeves.
The police have gone, she said. It's all over.
She gave a deep sigh.
May I request one little word with you, mademoiselle?
She led the way into the morning room, and Poirot followed, shutting the door.
Well?
She looked a little surprised.
One little question, mademoiselle. Were you tonight at any time in the flower border, outside the study window?
Yes, she nodded. About 7 o'clock, and again just before dinner.
I do not understand, he said.
Well, I can't see that there is anything to understand, as you call it, she said coldly. I was picking Michaelmas daisies for the table. I always do the flowers. That was about 7 o'clock.
And afterward? Later?
By that. As a matter of fact, I dropped a spot of hair oil on my dress, just on the shoulder here. It was just as I was ready to come down. I didn't want to change the dress. I remembered I'd seen a late rose in bud in the border. I ran out and picked it and pinned it in. See?
She came close to him and lifted the head of the rose. Poirot saw the minute grease spot. She remained close to him, her shoulder almost brushing his.
And what time was this?
Oh, about 8:10, I suppose.
You did not try the window?
I believe I did, yes. I thought it would be quicker to go in that way. But it was fastened.
I see.
Poirot drew a deep breath.
And the shot, he said. Where were you when you heard that? Still in the flower border?
Oh, no, it was 2 or 3 minutes later, just before I came in by the side door.
Do you know what this is, mademoiselle?
On the palm of his hand he held out the tiny silk rosebud. She examined it coolly.
It looks like a rosebud, off my little evening bag. Where did you find it?
It was in Mr. Keene's pocket, said Poirot dryly.
Did you give it to him, mademoiselle?
Did he tell you I gave it to him?
Poirot smiled.
When did you give it him, mademoiselle?
Last night.
Did he warn you to say that, mademoiselle?
What do you mean? She asked angrily. But Poirot did not answer. He strode out of the room and into the drawing room. Barling, Keane, and Marshall were there. He went straight up to them.
Monsieur, he said brusquely, will you follow me to the study?
He passed out into the hall and addressed Joan and Harry.
You two, I pray of you. And will somebody request Madame to come?
I thank you.
Ah, and here is the excellent Digby. Digby, a little question, a very important little question. Did Miss Cleves arrange some Michaelmas daisies before dinner?
The butler looked bewildered.
Yes, sir, she did.
Are you sure?
Quite sure, sir.
Très bien. Now, come, all of you.
Inside the study, he faced them.
I have asked you to come here for a reason. The case is over. The police have come and gone. They say Mr. Litcham Roche has shot himself. All is finished.
He paused.
But I, Hercule Poirot, say that it is not finished.
As startled eyes turned to him, the door opened, and Mrs. Litcham Roche floated into the room.
I was saying, madame, that this case is not finished. It is a matter of the psychology. Mr. Litcham Roche, he had the manie de grandeur. He was a king. Such a man does not kill himself. No, no. He may go mad, but he does not kill himself. Mr. Litcham Roche did not kill himself. He paused. He was killed.
Killed? Marshall gave a short laugh.
Alone in a room, with a door and window locked?
All the same, said Poirot stubbornly, he was killed.
And got up and locked the door and shut the window afterwards, I suppose, said Diana cuttingly.
I will show you something, said Poirot, going to the window. He turned the handle of the French windows and then pulled gently.
See? They are open. Now I close them, but without turning the handle. Now the window is closed, but not fastened. Now.
He gave a short, jarring blow, and the handle turned, shooting the bolt down into its socket.
You see, said Poirot softly, it is very loose, this mechanism. It could be done from outside quite easily.
He turned, his manner grim.
When that shot was fired, at 8:12, there were four people in the hall. Four people have an alibi. Where were the other three?
You, madame.
In your room. You, Monsieur Barling. Were you too in your room?
I was.
And you, mademoiselle, were in the garden.
So you have admitted.
I don't see, began Diana.
Wait.
He turned to Mrs. Litcham Roche. Tell me, madame, have you any idea of how your husband left his money?
Hubert read me his will. He said I ought to know. He left me 3,000 a year, chargeable on the estate, and the dower house, or the townhouse, whichever I preferred. Everything else he left to Diana, on condition that if she married, her husband must take the name.
Ah.
But then he made a codicil thing, a few weeks ago, that was.
Yes, mother?
He still left it all to Diana, but on condition that she married Mr. Barling. If she married anyone else, it was all to go to his nephew, Harry Dalehouse.
But the codicil was only made a few weeks ago, purred Poirot. Mademoiselle may not have known of that.
He stepped forward accusingly.
Mademoiselle Diana, you want to marry Captain Marshall, do you not? Or is it Mr. Keene?
She walked across the room and put her arm through Marshall's sound one.
Go on, she said. I will put the case against you, mademoiselle. You loved Captain Marshall. You also loved money. Your adopted father, he would never have consented to your marrying Captain Marshall, But if he dies, you are fairly sure that you get everything. So, you go out. You step over the flower border to the window, which is open. You have with you the pistol, which you have taken from the writing table drawer. You go up to your victim, talking amiably. You fire. You drop the pistol by his hand, having wiped it, then pressed his fingers on it. You go out again, shaking the window till the bolt drops. You come into the house. Is that how it happened? I am asking you, mademoiselle.
No! Diana screamed. No! No!
He looked at her. Then he smiled. No, he said. It was not like that. It may have been so. It is plausible. It is possible. But it cannot have been like that for two reasons. The first reason is that you picked Michaelmas daisies at 7 o'clock. The second arises from something that Mademoiselle here told me. He turned toward Joan, who stared at him in bewilderment. He nodded encouragement. But yes, Mademoiselle, you told me that you hurried downstairs because you thought it was the second gong sounding, having already heard the first. He shot a rapid glance round the room. You do not see what that means, he cried. You do not see. Look, look. He sprang forward to the chair where the victim had sat. Did you notice how the body was? Not sitting square to the desk, no. Sitting sideways to the desk, facing the window. Is that a natural way to commit suicide? Jamais, jamais. You write your apologia, sorry, on a piece of paper. You open the drawer, you take out the pistol, you hold it to your head, and fire. That is the way of suicide. But now, consider murder. The victim sits at his desk. The murderer stands beside him, talking. And talking still, fires. Where does the bullet go then? He paused. Straight through the head, through the door, if it is open, and so hits the gong. Ah, you begin to see. That was the first gong, heard only by Mademoiselle, since her room is above. What does our murderer do next? Shuts the door, locks it, puts the key in the dead man's pocket, then turns the body sideways in the chair, presses the dead man's fingers on the pistol, and then drops it by his side. Cracks the mirror on the wall as a final spectacular touch. In short, arranges his suicide. Then, out through the window, the bolt is shaken home, the murderer steps not on the grass where footprints must show, but on the flower bed, where they can be smoothed out behind him, leaving no trace. Then, back into the house, and at 8:12, when he is alone in the drawing room, he fires a service revolver out of the drawing room window and dashes out into the hall. Is that how you did it, Mr. Geoffrey Keane? Fascinated, the secretary stared at the accusing figure drawing nearer to him. Then, with a gurgling cry, he fell to the ground. I think I am answered, said Poirot. Captain Marshall, will you ring up the police? He bent over the prostrate form. I fancy he will still be unconscious when they come. Geoffrey Keane, murmured Diana. But what motive had he? I fancy that as secretary he had certain opportunities. Accounts, checks. Something awakened Mr. Litcham Roche's suspicions. He sent for me. Why for you? Why not the police? I think, mademoiselle, you can answer that question. Monsieur suspected that there was something between you and that young man. To divert his mind from Captain Marshall, you had flirted shamelessly with Mr. Keane. But yes, you need not deny. Mr. Keane gets wind of my coming and acts promptly. The essence of his scheme is that the crime must seem to take place at 8:12 when he has an alibi. His one danger is the bullet, which must be lying somewhere near the gong, and which he has not had time to retrieve. When we are all on our way to the study, he picks that up. At such a tense moment, he thinks no one will notice, but me, I notice everything. I question him. He reflects a little minute, and then he plays the comedy. He insinuates that what he picked up was the silk rosebud. He plays the part of the young man in love, shielding the lady he loves. Oh, it was very clever. And if you had not picked Michaelmas daisies... I don't understand what they have to do with it. You do not? Listen. There were only 4 footprints in the bed. But when you were picking the flowers, you must have made many more than that. So, in between your picking the flowers and your coming to get the rosebud, someone must have smoothed over the bed. Not a gardener. No gardener works after 7. Then it must be someone guilty. It must be the murderer. The murder was committed before the shot was heard.
But why did nobody hear the real shot? Asked Harry.
A silencer. They will find that, and the revolver thrown into the shrubbery.
What a risk!
Why a risk? Everyone was upstairs, dressing for dinner. It was a very good moment. The bullet was the only contretemps, and even that, as he thought, passed off well.
Poirot picked it up.
He threw it under the mirror when I was examining the window with Mr. Dalehouse.
Oh!
Diana wheeled on Marshall.
Marry me, John, and take me away.
Barling coughed.
My dear Diana, under the terms of my friend's will...
I don't care, the girl cried. We can draw pictures on pavements.
There's no need to do that, said Harry. We'll go halves, Di. I'm not going to bag things because Uncle had a bee in his bonnet. Suddenly there was a cry. Mrs. Litcham Roche had sprung to her feet.
Monsieur Poirot, the mirror... He must have deliberately smashed it.
Yes, madame.
Oh.
She stared at him.
But it is unlucky to break a mirror.
It has proved very unlucky for Mr. Geoffrey Keane, said Poirot cheerfully. Yellow Iris. Hercule Poirot stretched out his feet towards the electric radiator set in the wall. Its neat arrangement of red-hot bars pleased his orderly mind. A coal fire, he mused to himself, was always shapeless and haphazard. Never did it achieve the symmetry. The telephone bell rang. Poirot rose, glancing at his watch as he did so. The time was close on 11:30. He wondered who was ringing him up at this hour. It might, of course, be a wrong number. And it might, he murmured to himself with a whimsical smile, be a millionaire newspaper proprietor, found dead in the library of his country house with a spotted orchid clasped in his left hand and a page torn from a cookbook pinned to his breast. Smiling at the pleasing conceit, he lifted the receiver. Immediately a voice spoke. A soft, husky woman's voice, with a kind of desperate urgency about it.
Is that Monsieur Hercule Poirot? Is that Monsieur Hercule Poirot?
Hercule Poirot speaks.
Monsieur Poirot, can you come at once? At once? I'm in danger, in great danger. I know it,
Poirot said sharply.
Who are you? Where are you speaking from?
The voice came more faintly, but with an even greater urgency.
At once. It's life or death. The gendarmerie scene, at once, table with yellow irises.
There was a pause, a queer kind of gasp. The line went dead. Hercule Poirot hung up. His face was puzzled. He murmured between his teeth,
There is something here very curious.
In the doorway of the gendarmerie scene, fat Luigi hurried forward.
Buonasera, Monsieur Poirot. You desire a table, yes?
No, no, my good Luigi. I seek here for some friends. I will look round. Perhaps they are not here yet. Ah, let me see. That table there in the corner with the yellow irises. A little question, by the way, if it is not indiscreet. On all the other tables there are tulips, pink tulips. Why, on that one table, do you have yellow irises?
Luigi shrugged his expressive shoulders.
A command, monsieur. A special order. Without doubt the favorite flowers of one of the ladies. That table is the table of Mr. Barton Russell, an American immensely rich. Aha! One must study the whims of the ladies, must one not, Luigi?
Monsieur has said it, said Luigi.
I see at that table an acquaintance of mine. I must go and speak to him.
Poirot skirted his way delicately round the dancing floor on which couples were revolving. The table in question was set for six, but it had at the moment only one occupant, a young man who was thoughtfully, and it seemed pessimistically, drinking champagne. He was not at all the person that Poirot had expected to see. It seemed impossible to associate the idea of danger or melodrama with any party of which Tony Chapel was a member. Poirot paused delicately by the table.
"Ah, it is it not my friend Anthony Chapel?"
"By all that's wonderful! Poirot, the police hound!" cried the young man. "Not Anthony, my dear fellow. Tony to friends." He drew out a chair. "Come, sit with me. Let us discourse on crime. Let us go further and drink to crime." He poured champagne into an empty glass. "But what are you doing in this haunt of song and dance and merriment, my dear Poirot? We have no bodies here. Positively not a single body to offer you." Poirot sipped the champagne. "You seem very gay, mon cher."
"Gay?
I'm steeped in misery, wallowing in gloom. Tell me, you hear this tune they're playing? You recognize it?" Poirot hazarded cautiously.
"Something perhaps to do with your baby having left you?"
"Not a bad guess," said the young man, "but wrong for once. There's nothing like love for making you miserable. That's what it's called."
"Aha!
My favorite tune," said Tony Chapel mournfully. "And my favorite restaurant, my favorite band, and my favorite girl's here, and she's dancing it with somebody else."
"Hence the melancholy," said Poirot.
"Exactly. Pauline and I, you see, have had what the vulgar call words. That is to say, she's had 95 words to 5 of mine out of every 100. My 5 are, 'But darling, I can explain.' Then she starts in on her 95 again, and we get no further. I think," said Tony sadly, "that I shall poison myself."
"Pauline?"
murmured Poirot. "Pauline Weatherby, Barton Russell's young sister-in-law. Young, lovely, disgustingly rich. Tonight, Barton Russell gives a party. You know him? Big business, clean-shaven American, full of pep and personality. His wife was Pauline's sister."
"And who else is there at this party?"
"Oh, you'll meet them in a minute, when the music stops. There's Lola Valdez, you know, the South American dancer in the new show at the Metropole. And there's Stephen Carter. Do you know Carter? He's in the diplomatic service, very hush-hush, known as Silent Stephen. Sort of man who says, 'I'm not at liberty to state, etc., etc.' Oh, hello. Here they come." Poirot rose. He was introduced to Barton Russell, to Stephen Carter, to Signora Lola Valdez, a dark and luscious creature, and to Pauline Weatherby, very young, very fair, with eyes like cornflowers. Barton Russell said,
"What? Is this the great Monsieur Hercule Poirot? I am indeed pleased to meet you, sir. Won't you sit down and join us? That is, unless—" Tony Chapel broke in.
"He's got an appointment with a body, I believe. Or is it an absconding financier? Or the Raja of Borrio Bulaga's great ruby?"
"My friend, do you think I am never off duty? Can I not for once seek only to amuse myself?
Perhaps you've got an appointment with Carter here. The latest from the UN international situation now acute. The stolen plans must be found, or war will be declared tomorrow." Pauline Weatherby said cuttingly, "Must you be so completely idiotic, Tony?" "Sorry, Pauline." Tony Chapel relapsed into crestfallen silence.
"How severe you are, mademoiselle.
I hate people who play the fool all the time."
"I must be careful, I see. I must converse only of serious matters."
"Oh no, Monsieur Poirot, I didn't mean you." She turned a smiling face to him and said, "Are you really a kind of Sherlock Holmes and do wonderful deductions?"
"Ah, the deductions.
They are not so easy in real life.
But shall I try? Now then, I deduce that yellow irises are your favorite flowers."
"Quite wrong, Monsieur Poirot. Lilies of the valley, or roses." Poirot sighed.
"A failure. I will try once more. This evening, not very long ago, you telephoned to someone."
Pauline laughed and clapped her hands. "Quite right. It was not long after you arrived here." "Right again.
I telephoned the minute I got inside the doors.
Ah, that is not so good. You telephoned before you came to this table?
Yes.
Decidedly very bad.
Oh, no, I think it was very clever of you. How did you know I had telephoned?
That, mademoiselle, is the great detective's secret.
And the person to whom you telephoned, does the name begin with a P, perhaps? Or with an H?
Pauline laughed.
Quite wrong. I telephoned to my maid to post some frightfully important letters that I'd never sent off. Her name's Louise.
I am confused. Quite confused.
The music began again.
What about it, Pauline?
Asked Tony.
I don't think I want to dance again so soon, Tony.
Oh, isn't that too bad? Said Tony bitterly to the world at large.
Poirot murmured to the South American girl on his other side, Signora, I would not dare to ask you to dance with me. I am too much of the antique.
Lola Valdez said,
Ah, it is nonsense that you talk there. You are still young. Your hair, it is still black.
Poirot winced slightly.
Appalling. As your brother-in-law and your guardian, Barton Russell spoke heavily, I'm just going to force you onto the floor. This one's a waltz, and a waltz is about the only dance I really can do.
Why, of course, Barton. We'll take the floor right away.
Good girl, Pauline. That's swell of you.
They went off together. Tony tipped back his chair. Then he looked at Stephen Carter.
Talkative little fellow, aren't you, Carter? He remarked. Help to make a party go with your merry chatter, eh, what?
Really, Chapel. I don't know what you mean.
Oh, you don't you?
Tony mimicked him.
My dear fellow. Drink, man, if you won't talk.
No, thanks.
Then I will.
Stephen Carter shrugged his shoulders.
Excuse me, must just speak to a fellow I know over there. Fellow I was with at Eton.
Stephen Carter got up and walked to a table a few places away. Tony said gloomily,
Somebody ought to drown old Etonians at birth.
Hercule Poirot was still being gallant to the dark beauty beside him. He murmured,
I wonder, may I ask, what are the favourite flowers of mademoiselle? Ah, now, why is it you want to know?
Lola was arch.
Mademoiselle, if I send flowers to a lady, I am particular that they should be flowers she likes. Oh, that is very charming of you, Monsieur Poirot. I will tell you. I adore the big, dark red carnations, or the dark red roses.
Superb. Yes, superb.
You do not then like yellow irises?
Yellow flowers, no. They do not accord with my temperament.
How wise. Tell me, mademoiselle, did you ring up a friend tonight, since you arrived here?
I? Ring up a friend?
No. What a curious question.
Ah, but I am a very curious man.
I'm sure you are,
she rolled her dark eyes at him,
a very dangerous man.
Oh, no, not dangerous. Say, a man who may be useful in danger. You understand?
Lola giggled. She showed even white teeth.
No, she laughed. You are dangerous.
Hercule Poirot sighed.
I see that you do not understand. All this is very strange.
Tony came out of a fit of abstraction and said suddenly,
Lola, what about a spot of swoop and dip? Come along.
I will come, yes, since Monsieur Poirot is not brave enough.
Tony put an arm round her and remarked over his shoulder to Poirot as they glided off, You can meditate on crime yet to come, old boy.
Poirot said,
It is profound what you say there.
Yes, it is profound. He sat meditatively for a minute or two, then he raised a finger. Luigi came promptly, his wide Italian face wreathed in smiles.
Mon vieux, said Poirot, I need some information.
Always at your service, monsieur. I desire to know how many of these people at the table here have used the telephone tonight.
I can tell you, monsieur. The young lady, the one in white, she telephoned at once when she got here. Then she went to leave her cloak, and while she was doing that, the other lady came out of the cloakroom and went into the telephone box.
So, the signora did telephone. Was that before she came into the restaurant?
Yes, monsieur.
Anyone else?
No, monsieur.
All this, Luigi, gives me furiously to think.
Indeed, monsieur?
Yes, I think, Luigi, that tonight of all nights, I must have my wits about me. Something is going to happen, Luigi. And I am not at all sure what it is.
Anything I can do, monsieur?
Poirot made a sign. Luigi slipped discreetly away. Stephen Carter was returning to the table.
We are still deserted, Mr. Carter, said Poirot.
Quite, said the other.
You know Mr. Barton Russell well?
Yes, known him a good while.
His sister-in-law, little Miss Weatherby, is very charming.
Yes, pretty girl.
You know her well, too?
Quite.
Oh, quite,
said Poirot. Carter stared at him. The music stopped, and the others returned. Barton Russell said to a waiter,
Another bottle of champagne, quickly.
Then he raised his glass.
See here, folks. I'm going to ask you to drink a toast. To tell you the truth, there's an idea back of this little party tonight. As you know, I've ordered a table for six. There were only five of us. That gave us an empty place. Then, by a very strange coincidence, Monsieur Hercule Poirot happened to pass by, and I asked him to join our party. You don't know yet what an apt coincidence that was. You see, that empty seat tonight represents a lady, the lady in whose memory this party is being given. This party, ladies and gentlemen, is being held in memory of my dear wife, Iris, who died exactly 4 years ago on this very date.
There was a startled movement round the table. Barton Russell, his face quietly impassive, raised his glass.
I'll ask you to drink to her memory. Iris.
Iris?
Said Poirot sharply. He looked at the flowers. Barton Russell caught his glance and gently nodded his head. There were little murmurs round the table.
Iris.
Iris. Everyone looked startled and uncomfortable. Barton Russell went on, speaking with his slow, monotonous American intonation, each word coming out weightily.
It may seem odd to you all that I should celebrate the anniversary of a death in this way, by a supper party in a fashionable restaurant. But I have reason. Yes, I have a reason. For Monsieur Poirot's benefit, I'll explain.
He turned his head towards Poirot.
4 years ago tonight, Monsieur Poirot, there was a supper party held in New York. At it were my wife and myself, Mr. Stephen Carter, who was attached to the embassy in Washington, Mr. Anthony Chappell, who had been a guest in our house for some weeks, and Signora Valdez, who was at that time enchanting New York City with her dancing. Little Pauline here, he patted her shoulder, was only 16, but she came to the supper party as a special treat. You remember Pauline?
I remember. Yes.
Her voice shook a little.
Monsieur Poirot, on that night a tragedy happened. There was a roll of drums, and the cabaret started. The lights went down, all but a spotlight in the middle of the floor. When the lights went up again, Monsieur Poirot, my wife was seen to have fallen forward on the table. She was dead. Stone dead. There was potassium cyanide found in the dregs of her wine glass, and the remains of the packet was discovered in her handbag.
She had committed suicide? Said Poirot.
That was the accepted verdict.
It broke me up, Monsieur Poirot.
There was, perhaps, a possible reason for such an action. The police thought so. I accepted their decision.
He pounded suddenly on the table.
But I was not satisfied. No. For 4 years I've been thinking and brooding, and I'm not satisfied. I don't believe Iris killed herself.
I believe, Monsieur Poirot, that she was murdered by one of those people at the table.
Look here, sir.
Tony Chapel half sprung to his feet.
Be quiet, Tony, said Russell. I haven't finished.
One of them did it. I'm sure of that now. Someone who, under cover of the darkness, slipped the half-emptied packet of cyanide into her handbag. I think I know which of them it was. I mean to know the truth.
Lola's voice rose sharply.
You are mad, crazy. Who would have harmed her? No, you are mad. Me, I will not stay.
She broke off. There was a roll of drums. Barton Russell said,
The cabaret. Afterwards, we will go on with this. Stay where you are, all of you. I've got to go and speak to the dance band. Little arrangement I've made with them. He got up and left the table.
Extraordinary business, commented Carter.
Man's mad.
He is crazy, yes, said Lola.
The lights were lowered.
For two pins, I'd clear out, said Tony.
No,
Pauline spoke sharply. Then she murmured,
Oh dear. Oh dear. What is it, mademoiselle? Murmured Poirot.
She answered, almost in a whisper.
It's horrible. It's just like it was that night.
Shh, shh,
said several people. Poirot lowered his voice.
A little word in your ear,
he whispered, then patted her shoulder.
All will be well,
he assured her.
My God, listen,
cried Lola.
What is it, Signora?
It is the same tune, the same song that they played that night in New York. Barton Russell must have fixed it. I don't like this.
Courage, courage.
Then there was a fresh hush. A girl walked out into the middle of the floor, a coal-black girl with rolling eyeballs and white glistening teeth. She began to sing in a deep, hoarse voice, a voice that was curiously moving. I've forgotten you. I never think of you. The way you walked, the way you talked, the things you used to say. I've forgotten you. I never think of you. I couldn't say for sure today whether your eyes were blue or gray. I've forgotten you. I never think of you. I'm through thinking of you. I tell you I'm through thinking of you. 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 The sobbing tune. The deep, golden negro voice had a powerful effect. It hypnotized, cast a spell. Even the waiters felt it. The whole room stared at her, hypnotized by the thick, cloying emotion she distilled. A waiter passed softly round the table, filling up glasses, murmuring, Champagne, in an undertone. But all attention was on the one glowing spot of light, the black woman whose ancestors came from Africa, singing in her deep voice, I've forgotten you. I never think of you. Oh, what a lie. I shall think of you, think of you, think of you, till I die. The applause broke out frenziedly. The lights went up. Barton Russell came back and slipped into his seat.
She's great, that girl, cried Tony.
But his words were cut short by a low cry from Lola.
Look! Look!
And then they all saw. Pauline Weatherby dropped forward onto the table.
Lola cried, She's dead, just like Iris in New York.
Poirot sprang from his seat, signing to the others to keep back. He bent over the huddled form very gently, lifted a limp hand, and felt for a pulse. His face was white and stern. The others watched him. They were paralyzed, held in a trance. Slowly, Poirot nodded his head.
Yes, she is dead. La pauvre petite.
And I, sitting by her. Ah, but this time the murderer shall not escape.
Barton Russell, his face grey, muttered,
Just like Iris. She saw something. Pauline saw something that night. Only she wasn't sure. She told me she wasn't sure.
We must get the police.
Oh, God. Little Pauline,
Poirot said. Where is her glass? He raised it to his nose.
Yes, I can smell the cyanide. A smell of bitter almonds. The same method, the same poison.
He picked up her handbag. Let us look in her handbag. Barton Russell cried out. You don't believe this is suicide, too? Not on your life. Wait, Poirot commanded. No, there is nothing here. The lights went up, you see, too quickly. The murderer had not time. Therefore, the poison is still on him. Or her, said Carter. He was looking at Lola Valdez. She spat out, What do you mean? What do you say? That I killed her? It is not true, not true. Why should I do such a thing? You had a fancy for Barton Russell yourself in New York. That's the gossip I heard. Argentine beauties are notoriously jealous. That is a pack of lies. And I do not come from the Argentine. I come from Peru. Ah, I spit on you. She lapsed into Spanish. I demand silence, cried Poirot. It is for me to speak. Barton Russell said heavily, Everyone must be searched. Poirot said calmly, No, no. It is not necessary. What do you mean, not necessary? I, Hercule Poirot, know. I see with the eyes of the mind, and I will speak. Monsieur Carter, will you show us the packet in your breast pocket?
There's nothing in my pocket. What the hell?
Tony, my friend, if you will be so obliging. Carter cried out,
Damn you!
Tony flipped the packet neatly out before Carter could defend himself.
There you are, Monsieur Poirot, just as you said.
It's a damned lie, cried Carter.
Poirot picked up the packet, read the label. Cyanide potassium. The case is complete. Barton Russell's voice came thickly.
Carter, I always thought so. Iris was in love with you. She wanted to go away with you. You didn't want a scandal for the sake of your precious career, so you poisoned her. You'll hang for this, you dirty dog.
Silence!
Poirot's voice rang out, firm and authoritative. This is not finished yet. I, Hercule Poirot, have something to say. My friend here, Tony Chappell, he says to me when I arrive that I have come in search of crime. That is partly true. There was crime in my mind. But it was to prevent a crime that I came. And I have prevented it. The murderer, he planned well. But Hercule Poirot, he was one move ahead. He had to think fast, and to whisper quickly in Mademoiselle's ear when the lights went down. She is very quick and clever, Mademoiselle Pauline. She played her part well. Mademoiselle, will you be so kind as to show us that you are not dead, after all? Pauline sat up. She gave an unsteady laugh.
Resurrection of Pauline, she said. Pauline, darling, Tony, my sweet angel.
Barton Russell gasped.
I don't understand.
I will help you to understand, Mr. Barton Russell. Your plan has miscarried.
My plan?
Yes. Your plan.
Who was the only man who had an alibi during the darkness?
The man who left the table.
You, Mr. Barton Russell. But you returned to it under cover of the darkness, circling round it with a champagne bottle, filling up glasses, putting cyanide in Pauline's glass, and dropping the half-empty packet in Carter's pocket as you bent over him to remove a glass. Oh, yes. It is easy to play the part of a waiter in darkness when the attention of everyone is elsewhere. That was the real reason for your party tonight. The safest place to commit a murder is in the middle of a crowd. What the? Why the hell should I want to kill Pauline?
It might be, perhaps, a question of money. Your wife left you guardian to her sister. You mentioned that fact tonight. Pauline is 20. At 21, or on her marriage, you would have to render an account of your stewardship. I suggest that you could not do that. You have speculated with it. I do not know, Mr. Barton Russell, whether you killed your wife in the same way, or whether her suicide suggested the idea of this crime to you. But I do know that tonight you have been guilty of attempted murder. It rests with Miss Pauline whether you are prosecuted for that.
No, said Pauline. He can get out of my sight and out of this country. I don't want a scandal.
You had better go quickly, Mr. Barton Russell, and I advise you to be very careful in future.
Barton Russell got up, his face working.
To hell with you, you interfering little Belgian jackanapes!
He strode out angrily. Pauline sighed.
Monsieur Poirot, you've been wonderful.
You, mademoiselle, you have been the marvelous one. To pour away the champagne, to act the dead body so prettily.
She shivered.
You give me the creeps.
He said gently, It was you who telephoned me, was it not?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know. I was worried and frightened without knowing quite why I was frightened. Barton told me he was having this party to commemorate Iris's death. I realized that he had some scheme on, but he wouldn't tell me what it was. He looked so queer and so excited that I felt something terrible might happen. Only, of course, I never dreamed that he meant to get rid of me.
And so, mademoiselle?
I'd heard people talking about you. I thought if I could only get you here, perhaps it would stop anything happening. I thought that being a foreigner, if I rang up and pretended to be in danger and made it sound mysterious,
you thought the melodrama, it would attract me.
That is what puzzled me.
The message itself. Definitely it was what you call bogus. It did not ring true, but the fear in the voice, that was real.
Then I came, and you denied very categorically having sent me a message.
Well, I had to. Besides, I didn't want you to know it was me.
Ah, but I was fairly sure of that. Not at first, but I soon realized that the only two people who could know about the yellow irises on the table were you or Mr. Barton Russell.
Pauline nodded.
I heard him ordering them to be put on the table, she explained. That and his ordering a table for six, when I knew only five were coming, made me suspect.
She stopped, biting her lip.
What did you suspect, mademoiselle?
She said slowly,
I was afraid of something happening to Mr. Carter.
Stephen Carter cleared his throat. Unhurriedly, but quite decisively, he rose from the table.
I have to, thank you, Mr. Poirot. I owe you a great deal. You'll excuse me, I'm sure, if I leave you. Tonight's happenings have been rather upsetting. Looking after his retreating figure, Pauline said violently,
I hate him. I've always thought it was because of him that Iris killed herself. Or perhaps Barton killed her. Oh, it's all so hateful.
Poirot said gently,
Forget, mademoiselle. Forget. Let the past go. Think only of the present.
Pauline murmured,
Yes, you're right.
Poirot turned to Lola Valdez.
Signora, as the evening advances, I become more brave. If you would dance with me now...
Oh, yes, indeed. You are the cat's whiskers, Monsieur Poirot. I insist on dancing with you.
You are too kind, signora.
Tony and Pauline were left. They leant towards each other, across the table.
Darling Pauline. Oh, Tony, I've been such a nasty, spiteful, spit-firing little cat to you all day. Can you ever forgive me?
Angel, this is our tune again. Let's dance. They danced off, smiling at each other and humming softly. There's nothing like love for making you miserable. There's nothing like love for making you blue. Depressed, possessed, sentimental, temperamental. There's nothing like love for getting you down. There's nothing like love for driving you crazy. There's nothing like love for making you mad, abusive, elusive, suicidal, homicidal. There's nothing like love. There's nothing like love.
The Harlequin Tea Set. Mr. Satterthwaite clucked twice in vexation. Whether right in his assumption or not, he was more and more convinced that cars nowadays broke down far more frequently than they used to do. The only cars he trusted were old friends who had survived the test of time. They had their little idiosyncrasies, but you knew about those,
provided for them, fulfilled their wants before the demand became too acute. But new cars, full of new gadgets, different kinds of windows, an instrument panel newly and differently arranged, handsome in its glistening wood, but being unfamiliar, your groping hand hovered uneasily over fog lights, windscreen wipers, the choke, etc. All these things with knobs in a place you didn't expect them. And when your gleaming new purchase failed in performance, your local garage uttered the intensely irritating words, teething troubles. Splendid car, sir, these roadsters, super superbos. All the latest accessories, but bound to have their teething troubles, you know. Just as though a car were a baby. But Mr. Satterthwaite, being now of an advanced age, was strongly of the opinion that a new car ought to be fully adult, tested, inspected, and its teething troubles already dealt with before it came into its purchaser's possession. Mr. Satterthwaite was on his way to pay a weekend visit to friends in the country. His new car had already, on the way from London, given certain symptoms of discomfort, and was now drawn up in a garage, waiting for the diagnosis. Mr. Satterthwaite was waiting to find out how long it would take before he could resume progress towards his destination. His chauffeur was in consultation with a mechanic. Mr. Satterthwaite sat striving for patience. He had assured his hosts on the telephone the night before that he would be arriving in good time for tea. He would reach Doverton Kingsbourne, he assured them, well before 4 o'clock. He clucked again in irritation, and tried to turn his thoughts to something pleasant. It was no good sitting here in a state of acute irritation, frequently consulting his wristwatch, clucking once more, and giving, he had to realize, a very good imitation of a hen, pleased with its prowess in laying an egg. Yes, something pleasant. Yes. Now, hadn't there been something he had noticed as they were driving along? Not very long ago. Something that he had seen through the window, which had pleased and excited him. But before he had had time to think about it, the car's misbehavior had become more pronounced, and a rapid visit to the nearest service station had been inevitable. What was it that he had seen? On the left? No, on the right. Yes, on the right, as they drove slowly through the village street. Next door to a post office. Yes, he was quite sure of that. Next door to a post office, because the sight of the post office had given him the idea of telephoning to the Addisons to break the news that he might be slightly late in his arrival. The post office. A village post office. And next to it? Yes, definitely next to it. Next door. Or if not next door, the door after. Something that had stirred old memories, and he had wanted... Yes. Just what was it he had wanted? Oh, dear. It would come to him presently. It was mixed up with a colour. Several colours. Yes, a colour or colours. Or a word. Some definite word that had stirred memories, thoughts, pleasures gone by, excitement, recalling something that had been vivid and alive, something which he himself had not only seen, but observed. No, he had done more. He had taken part. Taken part in... What? And why? And where? All sorts of places. The answer came quickly at the last thought. All sorts of places. On an island, in Corsica, at Monte Carlo watching the croupier, spinning his roulette wheel, a house in the country, all sorts of places. And he had been there. And someone else. Yes, someone else. It all tied up with that. He was getting there at last. If he could just... He was interrupted at that moment by the chauffeur, coming to the window with the garage mechanic in tow behind him. "Won't be long now, sir," the chauffeur assured Mr. Satterthwaite cheerfully. "Matter of 10 minutes or so. Not more."
"Nothing seriously wrong," said the mechanic, in a low, hoarse country voice. "Teething troubles, as you might say."
Mr. Satterthwaite did not cluck this time. He gnashed his own teeth. A phrase he had often read in books, and which in old age he seemed to have got into the habit of doing himself, due perhaps to the slight looseness of his upper plate. Really, teething trouble, toothache, teeth gnashing, false teeth, one's whole life centred, he thought, about teeth.
"Doverton Kingsbourne's only a few miles away," said the chauffeur.
And I've a taxi here. You could go on in that, sir, and I'll bring the car up later as soon as it's fixed.
No, said Mr. Satterthwaite.
He said the word explosively, and both the chauffeur and the mechanic looked startled. Mr. Satterthwaite's eyes were sparkling. His voice was clear and decisive. Memory had come to him.
I propose, he said, to walk along the road we have just come by. When the car is ready, you will pick me up there. The Harlequin Cafe, I think it's called.
That's not very much of a place, sir, the mechanic advised.
That is where I shall be,
said Mr. Satterthwaite, speaking with a kind of regal autocracy. He walked off briskly. The two men stared after him.
Don't know what's got into him, said the chauffeur. Never seen him like that before.
The village of Kingsbourne Ducas did not live up to the old-world grandeur of its name. It was a smallish village, consisting of one street, a few houses, shops that were dotted rather unevenly, sometimes betraying the fact that they were houses which had been turned into shops, or that they were shops which now existed as houses, without any industrial intentions. It was not particularly old-world or beautiful. It was just simple and rather unobtrusive. Perhaps that was why, thought Mr. Satterthwaite, that a dash of brilliant colour had caught his eye. Ah, here he was at the post office. The post office was a simply functioning post office, with a pillar box outside, a display of some newspapers and some postcards, and surely next to it, yes, there was the sign up above. The Harlequin Cafe. A sudden qualm struck Mr. Satterthwaite. Really, he was getting too old. He had fancies. Why should that one word stir his heart? The Harlequin Cafe. The mechanic at the service station had been quite right. It did not look like a place in which one would really be tempted to have a meal. A snack, perhaps. A morning coffee. Then why? But he suddenly realized why. Because the cafe, or perhaps one could better put it as the house that sheltered the cafe, was in two portions. One side of it had small tables with chairs round them, arranged ready for patrons who came here to eat. But the other side was a shop that sold china. It was not an antique shop. It had no little shelves of glass vases or mugs. It was a shop that sold modern goods. And the show window that gave on the street was at the present moment housing every shade of the rainbow. A tea set of largish cups and saucers, each one of a different colour. Blue, red, yellow, green, pink, purple. Really, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, a wonderful show of colour. No wonder it had struck his eye as the car had passed slowly beside the pavement, looking ahead for any sign of a garage or a service station. It was labelled with a large card as a Harlequin tea set. It was the word Harlequin, of course, which had remained fixed in Mr. Satterthwaite's mind, although just far enough back in his mind so that it had been difficult to recall it. The gay colours. The Harlequin colours. And he had thought, wondered, had the absurd but exciting idea that in some way here was a call to him. To him specially. Here, perhaps eating a meal or purchasing cups and saucers, might be his own old friend, Mr. Harley Quinn. How many years was it since he had last seen Mr. Quinn? A large number of years. Was it the day he had seen Mr. Quinn walking away from him down a country lane? Lover's Lane, they had called it. He had always expected to see Mr. Quinn again, once a year at least, possibly twice a year. But no. That had not happened. And so today, he had had the wonderful and surprising idea that here, in the village of Kingsbourne Ducas, he might once again find Mr. Harley Quinn.
Absurd of me, said Mr. Satterthwaite. Quite absurd of me. Really, the ideas one has as one gets old.
He had missed Mr. Quinn. Missed something that had been one of the most exciting things in the late years of his life. Someone who might turn up anywhere, and who, if he did turn up, was always an announcement that something was going to happen. Something was going to happen to him. No, that was not quite right, not to him, but through him. That was the exciting part. just from the words that Mr. Quinn might utter. Words. Things he might show him. Ideas would come to Mr. Satterthwaite. He would see things. He would imagine things. He would find out things. He would deal with something that needed to be dealt with. And opposite him would sit Mr. Quinn, perhaps smiling approval. Something that Mr. Quinn said would start the flow of ideas. The active person would be he himself. He, Mr. Satterthwaite, the man with so many old friends, a man among whose friends had been duchesses, an occasional bishop, people that counted. Especially, he had to admit, people who had counted in the social world. Because, after all, Mr. Satterthwaite had always been a snob. He had liked duchesses. He had liked knowing old families, families who had represented the landed gentry of England for several generations. And he had had, too, an interest in young people, not necessarily socially important, young people who were in trouble, who were in love, who were unhappy, who needed help. Because of Mr. Quinn, Mr. Satterthwaite was enabled to give help. And now, like an idiot, he was looking into an unprepossessing village cafe and a shop for modern china and tea sets and casseroles, no doubt. "All the same," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself, "I must go in. Now I've been foolish enough to walk back here, I must go in, just, well, just in case. They'll be longer, I expect, doing the car than they say. It will be more than 10 minutes. Just in case there was anything interesting inside." He looked once more at the window full of china. He appreciated suddenly that it was good china, well made, a good modern product. He looked back into the past, remembering. The Duchess of Leith, he remembered. What a wonderful old lady she had been. How kind she had been to her maid on the occasion of a very rough sea voyage to the island of Corsica. She had ministered to her with the kindliness of a ministering angel, and only on the next day had she resumed her autocratic, bullying manner, which the domestics of those days had seemed able to stand quite easily without any sign of rebellion. Maria. Yes, that's what the Duchess's name had been. Dear old Maria Leith. Ah, well. She had died some years ago, but she had had a harlequin breakfast set, he remembered. Yes, big round cups in different colours. Black, yellow, red, and a particularly pernicious shade of puce. Puce, he thought, must have been a favourite colour of hers. She had had a Rockingham tea set, he remembered, in which the predominating colour had been puce decorated with gold. Ah, sighed Mr. Satterthwaite. Those were the days. Well, I suppose I'd better go in. Perhaps order a cup of coffee or something. It will be very full of milk, I expect, and possibly already sweetened. But still, one has to pass the time. He went in. The cafe side was practically empty. It was early, Mr. Satterthwaite supposed, for people to want cups of tea, and anyway, very few people did want cups of tea nowadays, except, that is, occasionally elderly people in their own homes. There was a young couple in the far window, and two women gossiping at a table against the back wall. "I said to her," one of them was saying. "I said you can't do that sort of thing. No, it's not the sort of thing that I'll put up with. And I said the same to Henry, and he agreed with me." It shot through Mr. Satterthwaite's mind that Henry must have rather a hard life, and that no doubt he had found it always wise to agree, whatever the proposition put to him might be. The most unattractive woman with the most unattractive friend. He turned his attention to the other side of the building, murmuring, "May I just look round?" There was quite a pleasant woman in charge, and she said, "Oh, yes, sir. We've got a good stock at present." Mr. Satterthwaite looked at the coloured cups, picked up one or two of them, examined the milk jug, picked up a china zebra and considered it, examined some ashtrays of a fairly pleasing pattern. He heard chairs being pushed back, and turning his head, noted that the two middle-aged women, still discussing former grievances, had paid their bill and were now leaving the shop. As they went out of the door, a tall man in a dark suit came in. He sat down at the table which they had just vacated. His back was to Mr. Satterthwaite, who thought that he had an attractive back. Lean, strong, well-muscled, but rather dark and sinister-looking, because there was very little light in the shop. Mr. Satterthwaite looked back again at the ashtrays.
I might buy an ashtray, so as not to cause a disappointment to the shop owner, he thought.
As he did so, the sun came out suddenly. He had not realized that the shop had looked dim because of the lack of sunshine. The sun must have been under a cloud for some time. It had clouded over, he remembered, at about the time they had got to the service station. But now there was this sudden burst of sunlight. It caught up the colours of the china, and through a coloured glass window of somewhat ecclesiastical pattern, which must, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, have been left over in the original Victorian house. The sun came through the window and lit up the dingy café. In some curious way, it lit up the back of the man who had just sat down there. Instead of a dark black silhouette, there was now a festoon of colours, red and blue and yellow, and suddenly Mr. Satterthwaite realized that he was looking at exactly what he had hoped to find. His intuition had not played him false. He knew who it was who had just come in and sat down there. He knew so well that he had no need to wait until he could look at the face. He turned his back on the china, went back into the cafe, round the corner of the round table, and sat down opposite the man who had just come in.
"Mr. Quinn," said Mr. Satterthwaite, "I knew somehow it was going to be you."
Mr. Quinn smiled. "You always know so many things," he said.
"It's a long time since I've seen you," said Mr. Satterthwaite.
"Does time matter?" said Mr. Quinn.
"Perhaps not. You may be right. Perhaps not."
"May I offer you some refreshment?"
"Is there any refreshment to be had?" said Mr. Satterthwaite doubtfully. "I suppose you must have come in for that purpose."
"One is never quite sure of one's purpose, is one?" said Mr. Quinn.
"I'm so pleased to see you again," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "I'd almost forgotten, you know. I mean, forgotten the way you talk. The things you say, the things you make me think of, the things you make me do."
"I make you do? You are so wrong. You have always known yourself just what you want to do and why you want to do it, and why you know so well that it has to be done."
"I only feel that when you are here."
"Oh, no," said Mr. Quinn lightly. "I have nothing to do with it. I am just, as I've often told you, I am just passing by. That is all."
"Today you are passing by through Kingsbourne Duquesne."
"And you are not passing by. You are going to a definite place. Am I right?"
"I'm going to see a very old friend, a friend I have not seen for a good many years. He is old now, somewhat crippled. He has had one stroke. He has recovered from it quite well, but one never knows."
"Does he live by himself?"
"Not now, I am glad to say. His family have come back from abroad. What is left of his family, that is. They have been living with him now for some months. I am glad to be able to come and see them again all together. Those, that's to say, that I have seen before, and those that I have not seen."
"You mean children?"
"Children and grandchildren."
Mr. Satterthwaite sighed. Just for a moment, he was sad that he had had no children, and no grandchildren, and no great-grandchildren himself. He did not usually regret it at all. "They have some special Turkish coffee here," said Mr. Quinn. "Really good of its kind. Everything else is, as you have guessed, rather unpalatable. But one can always have a cup of Turkish coffee, can one not? Let us have one, because I suppose you will soon have to get on with your pilgrimage, or whatever it is." In the doorway came a small black dog. He came and sat down by the table and looked up at Mr. Quinn.
"Your dog?" said Mr. Satterthwaite.
"Yes. Let me introduce you to Hermes." He stroked the black dog's head. "Coffee," he said. "Tell Ali." The black dog walked from the table through a door at the back of the shop. They heard him give a short, incisive bark. Presently he reappeared, and with him came a young man with a very dark complexion, wearing an emerald green pullover.
"Coffee, Ali," said Mr. Quinn. "Two coffees."
"Turkish coffee. That's right, isn't it, sir?"
He smiled and disappeared. The dog sat down again.
"Tell me," said Mr. Satterthwaite, "tell me where you've been and what you've been doing and why I have not seen you for so long."
"I have just told you that time really means nothing. It is clear in my mind, and I think it is clear in yours, the occasion when we last met."
"A very tragic occasion," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "I do not really like to think of it."
"Because of death? But death is not always a tragedy. I have told you that before."
"No," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "Perhaps that death, the one we are both thinking of, was not a tragedy, but all the same..."
"But all the same, it is life that really matters." "You are quite right, of course," said Mr. Quinn. "Quite right, it is life that matters. We do not want someone young, someone who is happy, or could be happy, to die. Neither of us want that, do we? That is the reason why we must always save a life when the command comes."
"Have you what a command for me?"
"Me? Command for you?"
Harley Quinn's long, sad face brightened into its peculiarly charming smile.
"I have no commands for you, Mr. Satterthwaite. I have never had commands. You yourself know things, see things, know what to do, do them. It has nothing to do with me."
"Oh, yes, it has," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "You're not going to change my mind on that point.
But tell me, where have you been during what is too short to call time?"
"Well, I have been here and there, in different countries, different climates, different adventures. But mostly, as usual, just passing by. I think it is more for you to tell me not only what you have been doing, but what you are going to do now. More about where you are going, who you are going to meet, your friends, what they are like."
"Oh, of course I will tell you. I should enjoy telling you, because I've been wondering, thinking, you know, about these friends I am going to. When you have not seen a family for a long time, when you have not been closely connected with them for many years, it is always a nervous moment when you are going to resume old friendships and old ties."
"You are so right," said Mr. Quinn.
The Turkish coffee was brought in little cups of oriental pattern. Ali placed them with a smile and departed. Mr. Satterthwaite sipped approvingly.
"As sweet as love, as black as night, and as hot as hell. That is the old Arab phrase, isn't it?"
Ali smiled over his shoulder and nodded.
"Yes," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "I must tell you where I am going, though what I am doing hardly matters. I am going to renew old friendships, to make acquaintance with the younger generation. Tom Addison, as I have said, is a very old friend of mine. We did many things together in our young days. Then, as often happens, life parted us. He was in the diplomatic service, went abroad for several foreign posts in turn. Sometimes I went and stayed with him. Sometimes I saw him when he was home in England. One of his many posts was in Spain. He married a Spanish girl, a very beautiful, dark girl called Pilar. He loved her very much."
"They had children?"
"Two daughters. A fair-haired baby like her father, called Lily, and a second daughter, Maria, who took after her Spanish mother. I was Lily's godfather. Naturally, I did not see either of the children very often, two or three times a year. Either I gave a party for Lily or went to see her at her school. She was a sweet and lovely person, very devoted to her father, and he was very devoted to her. But in between these meetings, these revivals of friendship, we went through some difficult times. You will know about it as well as I do. I and my contemporaries had difficulties in meeting through the war years. Lily married a pilot in the Air Force, a fighter pilot. Until the other day, I had even forgotten his name. Simon Gilead, Squadron Leader Gilead."
"He was killed in the war?"
"No, no, no. He came through safely.
After the war, he resigned from the Air Force, and he and Lily went out to Kenya, as so many did. They settled there, and they lived very happily. They had a son, a little boy called Roland. Later, when he was at school in England, I saw him once or twice. The last time, I think, was when he was 12 years old. A nice boy. He had red hair like his father. I've not seen him since, so I'm looking forward to seeing him today. He is 23, 24 by now. Time goes on so.
Is he married?
No. Not yet.
Ah, prospects of marriage?
Well, I wondered from something Tom Addison said in his letter. There is a girl cousin. The younger daughter, Maria, married the local doctor. I never knew her very well. It was rather sad. She died giving birth. Her little girl was called Inez, a family name chosen by her Spanish grandmother. As it happens, I have only seen Inez once since she grew up, a dark Spanish type, very much like her grandmother. But I am boring you with all this.
No, I want to hear it. It is very interesting to me.
I wonder why, said Mr. Satterthwaite. He looked at Mr. Quinn with that slight air of suspicion which sometimes came to him. You want to know all about this family? Why?
So that I can picture it, perhaps, in my mind.
Well, this house I am going to, Doverton Kingsbourne it is called, it is quite a beautiful old house, not so spectacular as to invite tourists or to be open to visitors on special days. Just a quiet country house to be lived in by an Englishman who has served his country and comes back to enjoy a mellow life when the age of retirement comes. Tom was always fond of country life. He enjoyed fishing. He was a good shot, and we had very happy days together in his family home of his boyhood. I spent many of my own holidays as a boy at Doverton Kingsbourne, and all through my life I have had that image in my mind. No place like Doverton Kingsbourne. No other house to touch it. Every time I drove near it, I would make a detour, perhaps, and just pass to see the view through a gap in the trees of the long lane that runs in front of the house, glimpses of the river where we used to fish, and of the house itself. And I would remember all the things that Tom and I did together. He has been a man of action, a man who has done things. And I have just been an old bachelor.
You have been more than that, said Mr. Quinn. You have been a man who made friends, who had many friends, and who has served his friends well.
Well, if I can think that, perhaps you are being too kind.
Not at all. You are very good company, besides. The stories you can tell, the things you've seen, the places you've visited, the curious things that have happened in your life, you could write a whole book on them, said Mr. Quinn.
I should make you the main character in it, if I did.
No, you would not, said Mr. Quinn. I am the one who passes by, that is all. But go on. Tell me more.
Well, this is just a family chronicle that I'm telling you, as I say. There were long periods, years of time, when I did not see any of them. But they have been always my old friends. I saw Tom and Pilar until the time when Pilar died. She died rather young, unfortunately. Lily, my godchild, Inez, the quiet doctor's daughter, who lives in the village with her father.
How old is the daughter?
Inez is 19 or 20, I think. I shall be glad to make friends with her.
So it is on the whole a happy chronicle?
Not entirely. Lily, my godchild, the one who went to Kenya with her husband, was killed there in an automobile accident. She was killed outright, leaving behind her a baby of barely a year old, little Roland. Simon, her husband, was quite broken-hearted. They were an unusually happy couple. However, the best thing happened to him that could happen, I suppose. He married again, a young widow who was the widow of a squadron leader, a friend of his, and who also had been left with a baby the same age. Little Timothy and little Roland had only 2 or 3 months in age between them. Simon's marriage, I believe, has been quite happy, though I've not seen them, of course, because they continued to live in Kenya. The boys were brought up like brothers. They went to the same school in England and spent their holidays usually in Kenya. I have not seen them, of course, for many years.
Well, You know what has happened in Kenya. Some people have managed to stay on. Some people, friends of mine, have gone to Western Australia and have settled again happily there with their families. Some have come home to this country. Simon Gilead and his wife and their two children left Kenya. It was not the same to them, and so they came home and accepted the invitation that has always been given them, and renewed every year by old Tom Addison. They have come, his son-in-law, his son-in-law's second wife, and the two children, now grown-up boys, or rather young men. They have come to live as a family there, and they are happy. Tom's other grandchild, Inez Horton, as I told you, lives in the village with her father, the doctor, and she spends a good deal of her time, I gather, at Doverton Kingsbourne with Tom Addison, who is very devoted to his granddaughter. They sound all very happy together there. He has urged me several times to come there and see, meet them all again, and so I accepted the invitation. Just for a weekend. It will be sad in some ways to see dear old Tom again, somewhat crippled, with perhaps not a very long expectation of life, but still cheerful and gay, as far as I can make out, and to see also the old house again, Doverton Kingsbourne, tied up with all my boyish memories. When one has not lived a very eventful life, when nothing has happened to one personally, and that is true of me, the things that remain with you are the friends, the houses, and the things you did as a child, and a boy, and a young man. There is only one thing that worries me. You should not be worried. What is it that worries you? That I might be disappointed. The house one remembers, one has dreamt of, when one might come to see it again, it would not be as one remembered it or dreamt it. A new wing would have been added. The garden would have been altered. All sorts of things can have happened to it. It is a very long time, really, since I have been there. I think your memories will go with you, said Mr. Quinn. I am glad you are going there. I have an idea, said Mr. Satterthwaite. Come with me. Come with me on this visit. You need not fear that you will not be welcome. Dear Tom Addison is the most hospitable fellow in the world. Any friend of mine would immediately be a friend of his. Come with me, you must, I insist. Making an impulsive gesture, Mr. Satterthwaite nearly knocked his coffee cup off the table. He caught it just in time. At that moment, the shop door was pushed open, its old-fashioned bell ringing. A middle-aged woman came in. She was slightly out of breath and looked somewhat hot. She was good-looking still, with a head of auburn hair, only just touched here and there with grey. She had that clear, ivory-coloured skin that so often goes with reddish hair and blue eyes, and she had kept her figure well. The newcomer swept a quick glance round the cafe and turned immediately into the china shop. "Oh," she exclaimed, "you've still got some of the Harlequin cups." "Yes, Mrs. Gilead, we had a new stock arrived in yesterday." "Oh, I'm so pleased. I really have been very worried. I rushed down here. I took one of the boys' motorbikes. They've gone off somewhere, and I couldn't find either of them. But I really had to do something. There was an unfortunate accident this morning with some of the cups, and we've got people arriving for tea and a party this afternoon. So, if you can give me a blue and a green, and perhaps I'd better have another red one as well in case. That's the worst of these different coloured cups, isn't it?" "Well, I know. They do say as it's a disadvantage, and you can't always replace the particular colour you want." Mr. Satterthwaite's head had gone over his shoulder now, and he was looking with some interest at what was going on. "Mrs. Gilead," the shopwoman had said. But of course, he realized it now, this must be... He rose from his seat, half hesitating, and then took a step or two into the shop. "Excuse me," he said, "but are you Mrs. Gilead from Doverton Kingsbourne?" "Oh, yes, I'm Beryl Gilead. She looked at him, wrinkling her brows a little. An attractive woman, Mr. Satterthwaite thought. Rather a hard face, perhaps, but competent. This was Simon Gilead's second wife. She hadn't got the beauty of Lily, but she seemed an attractive woman, pleasant and efficient. Suddenly a smile came to Mrs. Gilead's face. "I do believe." "Yes, of course. My father-in-law Tom has got a photograph of you, and you must be the guest we're expecting this afternoon.
You must be Mr. Satterthwaite.
Exactly, said Mr. Satterthwaite. That is who I am. But I shall have to apologize very much for being so much later in arriving than I said. But unfortunately my car has had a breakdown. It's in the garage now, being attended to. Oh, how miserable for you. But what a shame. But it's not tea time yet, don't worry. We've put it off anyway. As you probably heard, I ran down to replace a few cups which unfortunately got swept off a table this morning. Whenever one has anyone to lunch or tea or dinner, something like that always happens. There you are, Mrs. Gilliatt, said the woman in the shop. I'll wrap them up in there. Shall I put them in a box for you? No, if you'll just put some paper round them and put them in this shopping bag of mine, that'll be quite all right.
If you are returning to Doverton Kingsbourne, said Mr. Satterthwaite, I could give you a lift in my car. It will be arriving from the garage any minute now.
That's very kind of you. I wish, really, I could accept, but I've simply got to take the motorbike back. The boys will be miserable without it. They're going somewhere this evening.
Let me introduce you, said Mr. Satterthwaite.
He turned towards Mr. Quinn, who had risen to his feet and was now standing quite near.
This is an old friend of mine, Mr. Harley Quinn, whom I have just happened to run across here. I've been trying to persuade him to come along to Doverton Kingsbourne. Would it be possible, do you think, for Tom to put up yet another guest for tonight?
Oh, I'm sure it will be quite all right, said Beryl Gilliatt. I'm sure he'd be delighted to see another friend of yours. Perhaps it's a friend of his as well.
No, said Mr. Quinn. I've never met Mr. Addison, though I've often heard my friend Mr. Satterthwaite speak of him.
Well, then, do let Mr. Satterthwaite bring you. We should be delighted.
I am very sorry, said Mr. Quinn. Unfortunately, I have another engagement. Indeed, he looked at his watch, I must start for it immediately. I am late already, which is what comes of meeting old friends.
Here you are, Mrs. Gilliatt, said the saleswoman. It'll be quite all right, I think, in your bag.
Beryl Gilliatt put the parcel carefully into the bag she was carrying, then said to Mr. Satterthwaite,
Well, see you presently. Tea isn't until 5:15, so don't worry. I'm so pleased to meet you at last, having heard so much about you always from both Simon and from my father-in-law.
She said a hurried goodbye to Mr. Quinn and went out of the shop.
Bit of a hurry she's in, isn't she? Said the shopwoman. But she's always like that. Gets through a lot in a day, I'd say.
The sound of the motorbike outside was heard as it revved up.
Quite a character, isn't she? Said Mr. Satterthwaite.
It would seem so, said Mr. Quinn.
And I really can't persuade you?
I'm only passing by, said Mr. Quinn.
And when shall I see you again, I wonder now?
Oh, it will not be very long, said Mr. Quinn. I think you will recognize me when you do see me.
Have you nothing more? Nothing more to tell me? Nothing more to explain?
To explain what?
To explain why I have met you here.
You are a man of considerable knowledge, said Mr. Quinn. One word might mean something to you.
I think it would, and it might come in useful. What word?
Daltonism, said Mr. Quinn. He smiled.
I don't think...
Mr. Satterthwaite frowned for a moment.
Yes. Yes, I do know. Only, just for the moment, I can't remember.
Goodbye for the present, said Mr. Quinn. Here is your car. At that moment, the car was indeed pulling up by the post office door. Mr. Satterthwaite went out to it. He was anxious not to waste more time and keep his hosts waiting longer than need be, but he was sad all the same at saying goodbye to his friend.
There is nothing I can do for you,
he said, and his tone was almost wistful.
Nothing you can do for me?
For someone else?
I think so, very likely.
I hope I know what you mean.
I have the utmost faith in you, said Mr. Quinn. You always know things. You are very quick to observe and to know the meaning of things. You have not changed, I assure you. His hand rested for a moment on Mr. Satterthwaite's shoulder. Then he walked out and proceeded briskly down the village street in the opposite direction to Doverton Kingsbourne. Mr. Satterthwaite got into his car.
"I hope we shan't have any more trouble," he said.
His chauffeur reassured him. "Oh, it's no distance from here, sir. 3 or 4 miles at most, and she's running beautifully now." He ran the car a little way along the street and turned where the road widened, so as to return the way he had just come. He said again, "Only 3 or 4 miles." Mr. Satterthwaite said again, "Daltonism." It still didn't mean anything to him, but yet he felt it should. It was a word he'd heard used before. "Doverton Kingsbourne," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. He said it very softly under his breath. The two words still meant to him what they had always meant, a place of joyous reunion, a place where he couldn't get there too quickly, a place where he was going to enjoy himself, even though so many of those whom he had known would no longer be there. But Tom would be there, his old friend Tom, and he thought again of the grass and the lake and the river and the things they had done together as boys. Tea was set out upon the lawn. Steps led out from the French windows in the drawing room and down to where a big copper beech at one side and a cedar of Lebanon on the other made the setting for the afternoon scene. There were 2 painted and carved white tables and various garden chairs, upright ones with coloured cushions and lounging ones where you could lean back and stretch your feet out and sleep, if you wished to do so. Some of them had hoods over them to guard you from the sun. It was a beautiful early evening, and the green of the grass was a soft, deep colour. The golden light came through the copper beech, and the cedar showed the lines of its beauty against a soft, pinkish-golden sky. Tom Addison was waiting for his guest in a long basket chair, his feet up. Mr. Satterthwaite noted with some amusement what he remembered from many other occasions of meeting his host. He had comfortable bedroom slippers, suited to his slightly swollen, gouty feet, and the shoes were odd ones, 1 red and 1 green. "Good old Tom," thought Mr. Satterthwaite. "He hasn't changed, just the same," and he thought, "What an idiot I am. Of course I know what that word meant. Why didn't I think of it at once?"
"Thought you were never going to turn up, you old devil," said Tom Addison.
He was still a handsome old man, a broad face with deep-set, twinkling grey eyes, shoulders that were still square and gave him a look of power. Every line in his face seemed a line of good humour and of affectionate welcome.
"He never changes," thought Mr. Satterthwaite. "Can't get up to greet you," said Tom Addison. "Takes 2 strong men and a stick to get me on my feet. Now, do you know our little crowd, or don't you? You know Simon, of course."
"Oh, of course I do. It's a good few years since I've seen you, but you haven't changed much."
Squadron leader Simon Gilliatt was a lean, handsome man with a mop of red hair.
"Sorry you never came to see us when we were in Kenya," he said. "You'd have enjoyed yourself. Lots of things we could have shown you. Ah, well, one can't see what the future may bring. I thought I'd lay my bones in that country."
"Oh, we've got a very nice churchyard here," said Tom Addison. "Nobody's ruined our church yet by restoring it, and we haven't very much new building round about, so there's plenty of room in the churchyard still. We haven't had one of those terrible additions of a new intake of graves."
"What a gloomy conversation you're having," said Beryl Gilliatt, smiling.
"These are our boys," she said. "But you know them already, don't you, Mr. Satterthwaite?"
"I don't think I'd have known them now," said Mr. Satterthwaite.
Indeed, the last time he had seen the 2 boys was on a day when he had taken them out from their prep school. Although there was no relationship between them, they had had different fathers and mothers, yet the boys could have been, and often were, taken for brothers. They were about the same height, and they both had red hair, Roland, presumably, having inherited it from his father, and Timothy from his auburn-haired mother. There seemed also to be a kind of comradeship between them. Yet really, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, they were very different. The difference was clearer now, when they were, he supposed, between 22 and 25 years old. He could see no resemblance in Roland to his grandfather. Nor, apart from his red hair, did he look like his father. Mr. Satterthwaite had wondered sometimes whether the boy would look like Lily, his dead mother, but there again he could see little resemblance. If anything, Timothy looked more as a son of Lily's might have looked. The fair skin, and the high forehead, and a delicacy of bone structure. At his elbow, a soft, deep voice said, "I'm Inez. I don't expect you to remember me. It was quite a long time ago when I saw you." A beautiful girl, Mr. Satterthwaite thought at once, a dark type. He cast his mind back a long way to the days when he had come to be best man at Tom Addison's wedding to Pilar. She showed her Spanish blood, he thought, the carriage of her head and the dark aristocratic beauty. Her father, Dr. Horton, was standing just behind her. He looked much older than when Mr. Satterthwaite had seen him last. A nice man, and kindly. A good general practitioner. Unambitious, but reliable, and devoted, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, to his daughter. He was obviously immensely proud of her. Mr. Satterthwaite felt an enormous happiness creeping over him. All these people, he thought, although some of them strange to him, seemed like friends he had already known. The dark, beautiful girl, the two red-haired boys, Beryl Gilead fussing over the tea tray, arranging cups and saucers, beckoning to a maid from the house to bring out cakes and plates of sandwiches. A splendid tea. There were chairs that pulled up to the tables so that you could sit comfortably, eating all you wanted to eat. The boys settled themselves, inviting Mr. Satterthwaite to sit between them. He was pleased at that. He had already planned in his own mind that it was the boys he wanted to talk to first, to see how much they recalled to him Tom Addison in the old days. And he thought, Lily, how I wish Lily could be here now. Here he was, thought Mr. Satterthwaite, here he was back in his boyhood. Here where he had come and been welcomed by Tom's father and mother, an aunt or so, too. There had been a great uncle and cousins, and now, well, there were not so many in this family, but it was a family. Tom in his bedroom slippers, one red, one green, old but still merry and happy. Happy in those who were spread round him. And here was Doverton just, or almost just, as it had been. Not quite so well kept up, perhaps, but the lawn was in good condition. And down there he could see the gleam of the river through the trees, and the trees too. More trees than there had been. And the house needing, perhaps, another coat of paint, but not too badly. After all, Tom Addison was a rich man, well provided for, owning a large quantity of land, a man with simple tastes, who spent enough to keep his place up, but was not a spendthrift in other ways. He seldom travelled or went abroad nowadays, but he entertained. Not big parties, just friends. Friends who came to stay. Friends who usually had some connection going back into the past. A friendly house. He turned a little in his chair, drawing it away from the table and turning it sideways so that he could see better the view down to the river. Down there was the mill, of course, and beyond the other side there were fields. In one of the fields it amused him to see a kind of scarecrow, a dark figure on which birds were settling on the straw. Just for a moment he thought it looked like Mr. Harley Quinn. Perhaps, thought Mr. Satterthwaite, it is my friend Mr. Quinn. It was an absurd idea, and yet if someone had piled up the scarecrow and tried to make it look like Mr. Quinn, it could have had the sort of slender elegance that was foreign to most scarecrows one saw. "Are you looking at our scarecrow?" said Timothy. "We've got a name for him, you know. We call him Mr. Harley Barley." "Do you indeed?" said Mr. Satterthwaite. "Dear me, I find that very interesting." "Why do you find it interesting?" said Rowley, with some curiosity.
"Well, because it rather resembles someone that I know, whose name happens to be Harley. His first name, that is."
The boys began singing, "Harley Barley stands on guard. Harley Barley takes things hard. Guards the ricks and guards the hay, keeps the trespassers away."
"A cucumber sandwich, Mr. Satterthwaite?" said Beryl Gilead. "Or do you prefer a homemade pate one?"
Mr. Satterthwaite accepted the homemade pate. She deposited by his side a puce cup, the same colour as he had admired in the shop. How gay it looked, that tea set on the table. Yellow, red, blue, green, and all the rest of it. He wondered if each one had their favourite colour. Timothy, he noticed, had a red cup. Roland had a yellow one. Beside Timothy's cup was an object Mr. Satterthwaite could not at first identify. Then he saw it was a meerschaum pipe. It was years since Mr. Satterthwaite had thought of or seen a meerschaum pipe. Roland, noticing what he was looking at, said, "Tim brought that back from Germany when he went. He's killing himself with cancer, smoking his pipe all the time."
"Don't you smoke, Roland?"
"No, I'm not one for smoking. I don't smoke cigarettes, and I don't smoke pot either." Inez came to the table and sat down the other side of him. Both the young men pressed food upon her. They started a laughing conversation together. Mr. Satterthwaite felt very happy among these young people. Not that they took very much notice of him, apart from their natural politeness, but he liked hearing them. He liked, too, making up his judgment about them. He thought he was almost sure that both the young men were in love with Inez. Well, it was not surprising. Propinquity brings those things about. They had come to live here with their grandfather. A beautiful girl, Roland's first cousin, was living almost next door. Mr. Satterthwaite turned his head. He could just see the house through the trees where it poked up from the road just beyond the front gate. That was the same house that Dr. Horton had lived in last time he came here, 7 or 8 years ago. He looked at Inez. He wondered which of the two young men she preferred, or whether her affections were already engaged elsewhere. There was no reason why she should fall in love with one of these two attractive young specimens of the male race. Having eaten as much as he wanted, it was not very much, Mr. Satterthwaite drew his chair back, altering its angle a little so that he could look all around him. Mrs. Gilead was still busy, very much the housewife, he thought, making perhaps rather more of a fuss than she need of domesticity, continually offering people cakes, taking their cups away and replenishing them, handing things round. Somehow, he thought, it would be more pleasant and more informal if she let people help themselves. He wished she was not so busy a hostess. He looked up to the place where Tom Addison lay stretched out in his chair. Tom Addison was also watching Beryl Gilead. Mr. Satterthwaite thought to himself, he doesn't like her. No, Tom doesn't like her. Well, perhaps that's to be expected. After all, Beryl had taken the place of his own daughter, of Simon Gilead's first wife, Lily. My beautiful Lily, thought Mr. Satterthwaite again, and wondered why, for some reason, he felt that although he could not see anyone like her, yet Lily, in some strange way, was here. She was here at this tea party. I suppose one begins to imagine these things as one gets old, thought Mr. Satterthwaite. After all, why shouldn't Lily be here to see her son? He looked affectionately at Timothy, and then suddenly realized that he was not looking at Lily's son. Roland was Lily's son. Timothy was Beryl's son. I believe Lily knows I'm here. I believe she'd like to speak to me, thought Mr. Satterthwaite. Oh dear, I mustn't start imagining foolish things. For some reason he looked again at the scarecrow. It didn't look like a scarecrow now. It looked like Mr. Harley Quinn. Some tricks of the light, of the sunset, were providing it with colour, and there was a black dog, like Hermes, chasing the birds. "Colour," said Mr. Satterthwaite, and looked again at the table, and the tea set, and the people having tea. "Why am I here?" said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. "Why am I here, and what ought I to be doing? There's a reason." Now he knew, he felt, there was something, some crisis, something affecting all these people, or only some of them. Beryl Gilead, Mrs. Gilead, she was nervous about something, on edge. Tom? Nothing wrong with Tom. He wasn't affected. A lucky man to own this beauty, to own Doverton, and to have a grandson, so that when he died all this would come to Roland. All this would be Roland's. Was Tom hoping that Roland would marry Inez, Or would he have a fear of first cousins marrying? Though throughout history, Mr. Satterthwaite thought, brothers had married sisters with no ill result.
"Nothing must happen," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "Nothing must happen. I must prevent it."
Really, his thoughts were the thoughts of a madman. A peaceful scene. A tea set. The varying colours of the Harlequin cups. He looked at the white meerschaum pipe, lying against the red of the cup. Beryl Gilliatt said something to Timothy. Timothy nodded, got up and went off towards the house. Beryl removed some empty plates from the table, adjusting a chair or two, murmured something to Roland, who went across and offered a frosted cake to Dr. Horton. Mr. Satterthwaite watched her. He had to watch her. The sweep of her sleeve as she passed the table. He saw a red cup get pushed off the table. It broke on the iron feet of a chair. He heard her little exclamation as she picked up the bits. She went to the tea tray, came back and placed on the table a blue cup and saucer. She replaced the meerschaum pipe, putting it close against it. She brought the teapot and poured tea. Then she moved away. The table was untenanted now. Inez also had got up and left it, gone to speak to her grandfather.
"I don't understand," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. "Something's going to happen."
"What's going to happen?" A table with different coloured cups round. And yes, Timothy, his red hair glowing in the sun, red hair glowing with that same tint, that attractive sideways wave that Simon Gilliatt's hair had always had. Timothy, coming back, standing a moment, looking at the table with a slightly puzzled eye, then going to where the meerschaum pipe rested against the pale blue cup. Inez came back then. She laughed suddenly, and she said,
"Timothy, you're drinking your tea out of the wrong cup. The blue cup's mine. Yours is the red one."
And Timothy said, "Don't be silly, Inez. I know my own cup. It's got sugar in it, and you won't like it. Nonsense. This is my cup. The meerschaum's up against it." It came to Mr. Satterthwaite then, a shock. Was he mad? Was he imagining things? Was any of this real? He got up. He walked quickly towards the table, and as Timothy raised the blue cup to his lips, he shouted,
"Don't drink that!" He called, "Don't drink it, I say!"
Timothy turned a surprised face. Mr. Satterthwaite turned his head. Dr. Horton, rather startled, got up from his seat and was coming near. "What's the matter, Satterthwaite?"
"That cup! There's something wrong about it. Don't let the boy drink from it."
Horton stared at it.
"My dear fellow, I know what I'm saying. The red cup was his,"
said Mr. Satterthwaite,
"and the red cup's broken. It's been replaced with a blue one. He doesn't know the red from the blue, does he?"
Dr. Horton looked puzzled.
Do you mean, like Tom? Tom Addison. He's colorblind. You know that, don't you?"
"Oh, yes, of course, we all know that. That's why he's got odd shoes on today. He never knew red from green."
"This boy is the same."
But surely not. Anyway, there's never been any sign of it, in Roland."
"There might be, though, mightn't there?" said Mr. Satterthwaite. "I'm right in thinking, Daltonism, that's what they call it, don't they?"
"It was a name they used to call it by, yes.
It's not inherited by a female, but it passes through the female. Lily wasn't colorblind, but Lily's son might easily be colorblind."
"But, my dear Satterthwaite, Timothy isn't Lily's son. Rowley is Lily's son. I know they're rather alike, same age, same colored hair and things, but, well, perhaps you don't remember."
"No,"
said Mr. Satterthwaite.
I shouldn't have remembered. But I know now. I can see the resemblance, too. Roland's Beryl's son. They were both babies, weren't they, when Simon remarried? It is very easy for a woman looking after two babies, especially if both of them were going to have red hair. Timothy's Lily's son, and Roland is Beryl's son. Beryl's and Christopher Eden's. There is no reason why he should be colorblind. I know it, I tell you. I know it."
He saw Dr. Horton's eyes go from one to the other. Timothy, not catching what they said, but standing holding the blue cup and looking puzzled.
"I saw her buy it," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "Listen to me, man, you must listen to me. You've known me for some years. You know that I don't make mistakes if I say a thing positively."
"Quite true. I've never known you make a mistake."
"Take that cup away from him,"
said Mr. Satterthwaite. Take it back to your surgery, or take it to an analytic chemist and find out what's in it. I saw that woman buy that cup. She bought it in the village shop. She knew then that she was going to break a red cup, replace it by a blue, and that Timothy would never know that the colours were different. I think you're mad, Satterthwaite. But all the same, I'm going to do what you say. He advanced on the table, stretched out a hand to the blue cup. Do you mind letting me have a look at that? Said Dr. Horton. Of course, said Timothy. He looked slightly surprised. I think there's a flaw in the china here, you know. Rather interesting. Beryl came across the lawn. She came quickly and sharply. What are you doing? What's the matter? What's happening? Nothing's the matter, said Dr. Horton cheerfully. I just want to show the boys a little experiment I'm going to make with a cup of tea. He was looking at her very closely, and he saw the expression of fear, of terror. Mr. Satterthwaite saw the entire change of countenance. Would you like to come with me, Satterthwaite? Just a little experiment, you know. Matter of testing porcelain and different qualities in it nowadays. A very interesting discovery was made lately. Chatting, he walked along the grass. Mr. Satterthwaite followed him, and the two young men, chatting to each other, followed him. What's the doc up to now, Rowley? Asked Timothy. I don't know, said Roland. He seems to have got some very extraordinary ideas. Oh well, we shall hear about it later, I expect. Let's go and get our bikes. Beryl Gilead turned abruptly. She retraced her steps rapidly up the lawn towards the house. Tom Addison called to her.
Anything the matter, Beryl?
Something I'd forgotten, said Beryl Gilead. That's all. Tom Addison looked inquiringly towards Simon Gilead.
Anything wrong with your wife? He murmured.
Beryl?
Oh, no, not that I know of. I expected some little thing or other she's forgotten.
Nothing I can do for you, Beryl, he called.
No, I'll be back later.
She turned her head half sideways, looking at the old man lying back in the chair. She spoke suddenly and vehemently.
You silly old fool, you've got the wrong shoes on again today. They don't match. Do you know you've got one shoe that's red and one shoe that's green?
Ah, done it again, have I? Said Tom Addison. They look exactly the same colour to me, you know. It's odd, isn't it? But there it is.
She went past him, her steps quickening. Presently, Mr. Satterthwaite and Dr. Horton reached the gate that led out into the roadway. They heard a motorbicycle speeding along.
She's gone, said Dr. Horton. She's run for it. We ought to have stopped her, I suppose. Do you think she'll come back?
No, said Mr. Satterthwaite. I don't think she'll come back. Perhaps, he said thoughtfully, it's best left that way.
You mean?
It's an old house, said Mr. Satterthwaite.
An old family.
A good family. A lot of good people in it. One doesn't want trouble, scandal, everything brought upon it. Best to let her go, I think.
Tom Addison never liked her, said Dr. Horton. Never. He was always polite and kind, but he didn't like her.
And there's the boy to think of, said Mr. Satterthwaite.
The boy?
You mean the other boy, Roland. This way he needn't know about what his mother was trying to do.
Why did she do it? Why on earth did she do it?
You've no doubt now that she did, said Mr. Satterthwaite.
No, I've no doubt now. I saw her face, Satterthwaite, when she looked at me. I knew then that what you'd said was truth.
But why?
Greed, I suppose, said Mr. Satterthwaite. She hadn't any money of her own, I believe. Her husband, Christopher Eden, was a nice chap, by all accounts, but he hadn't anything in the way of means. But Tom Addison's grandchild has got big money coming to him. A lot of money. Property all around here has appreciated enormously. I've no doubt that Tom Addison will leave the bulk of what he has to his grandson. She wanted it for her own son, and through her own son, of course, for herself. She is a greedy woman. Mr. Satterthwaite turned his head back suddenly.
"Something's on fire over there," he said. "Good Lord, so it is. Oh, it's the scarecrow down in the field. Some young chap or other set fire to it, I suppose. But there's nothing to worry about. There are no ricks or anything anywhere near. It'll just burn itself out."
"Yes," said Mr. Satterthwaite.
"Well, you go on, Doctor. You don't need me to help you in your tests. I've no doubt of what I shall find. I don't mean the exact substance. But I've come to your belief that this blue cup holds death."
Mr. Satterthwaite had turned back through the gate. He was going now down in the direction where the scarecrow was burning. Behind it was the sunset. A remarkable sunset that evening. Its colours illuminated the air around it, illuminated the burning scarecrow.
"So, that's the way you've chosen to go," said Mr. Satterthwaite.
He looked slightly startled then, for in the neighbourhood of the flames he saw the tall, slight figure of a woman. A woman dressed in some pale mother-of-pearl colouring. She was walking in the direction of Mr. Satterthwaite. He stopped dead, watching.
"Lily," he said. "Lily."
He saw her quite plainly now. It was Lily, walking towards him. Too far away from him to see her face, but he knew very well who it was. Just for a moment or two, he wondered whether anyone else would see her, or whether the sight was only for him. He said, not very loud, only in a whisper,
"It's all right, Lily. Your son is safe."
She stopped then. She raised one hand to her lips. He didn't see her smile, but he knew she was smiling. She kissed her hand and waved it to him, and then she turned. She walked back towards where the scarecrow was disintegrating into a mass of ashes.
"She's going away again," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. "She's going away with him. They're walking away together. They belong to the same world, of course. They only come, those sort of people, they only come when it's a case of love, or death, or both."
He wouldn't see Lily again, he supposed, but he wondered how soon he would meet Mr. Quinn again. He turned, and then went back across the lawn towards the tea table and the Harlequin tea set, and beyond that to his old friend Tom Addison. Beryl wouldn't come back. He was sure of it. Doverton Kingsbourne was safe again. Across the lawn came the small black dog in flying leaps. It came to Mr. Satterthwaite, panting a little and wagging its tail. Through its collar was twisted a scrap of paper. Mr. Satterthwaite stooped and detached it, smoothing it out. On it, in coloured letters, was written a message. "Congratulations. To our next meeting. H.Q.
"Thank you, Hermes," said Mr. Satterthwaite,
and watched the black dog flying across the meadow to rejoin the two figures that he himself knew were there, but could no longer see.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.